independent Chicago hip-hop record label Closed Sessions, Chicago public school teacher Erica Wozniak, and another installment of Swap Meet. Now, here's your host, a man who is hoping Hypercolor makes a comeback, Justin Kaufman.
One of the best inventions of our time is put your hand on a shirt and it changes colors. Well, what else do you want? I want it to come back. Welcome to The Download here on WGN Radio. I'm Justin Kaufman with you till 11 o'clock tonight. What a beautiful night here in Chicago, Michigan Avenue. A buzz here as I sit in the Allstate Showcase studio. Lots to do tonight. What a show we have tonight. Every night it gets better and better. Tonight we're going to start right after the news. We're going to talk with CPS school teacher Erica Wozniak. Erica is just received the Everyday Hero Award from the American Federation of Teachers, National Award. For her work, not just as being a teacher and an advocate, but she's also, as she self-proclaimed, a strategic troublemaker. She'll talk about, she pens a lot of commentaries for the Chicago Tribune. She also hosts a show at the Hideout called The Girl Talk, Jen Sabella, Erica Wozniak. We'll talk with Erica coming up after the news about her award and about what she hopes transpires this summer when it comes to Chicago Public Schools and, of course, the Chicago Teachers Union. Coming up at 8 o'clock, our guests at the big table, the guys behind Closed Sessions. Closed Sessions is a record label, an independent hip-hop record label here in Chicago, Humboldt Park, that is just like signing and producing some of the best artists the city has to offer. It's pretty amazing, the people that come through there. Everyone from, you know, Vic Mensa to work with Chance the Rapper and all the others that are blowing up right now. Closed Session is something to do. So we'll talk about the music industry. We'll talk about independent music. We always do mention the fact that these artists are all going indie. They're not being signed, but Closed Sessions is one of those places that helps them get that music out. So we'll talk with Mike and Alex about that coming up in the 8 o'clock hour. Later in the show, we're going to talk with Urban Theater Company. It's their 10th anniversary, the company from Humboldt Park as well. They're remounting a show that was actually written by McDelia Cruz back in 1995, 20 years ago. It's called Lolita de Lares. And it's interesting because the story of Lolita Lebron, who was the Puerto Rican nationalist that shot up the House of Representatives back in 1954. And she went to prison. She ended up being pardoned by Jimmy Carter in 1979. These are stories that I will be honest in my ignorance that I am not familiar with Lolita Lebron's story, and I'm hoping that I'll learn more tonight about it. I'm sure there's listeners out there that are going to text me now and say, are you crazy? How do you not know that? But I don't. I'm being honest. You know, that's what attracted me to having a conversation about that, because it's wild and it feels like it's something that, you know, just couldn't happen in our society, and it did. So I'm interested in the story, and we'll talk with Urban Theater Company about the remount of that play, which begins, press night is tomorrow night. Also tonight, I want to come out of the closet, and I'm unapologetic. I am a rosé drinker. I know, let it sink in. I drink rosé, chilled rosé. I was at a wine tasting in California, and the guy made fun of me. He's like, here you go. Here, don't. He said something. He put it down, and he goes, you know, here you go. It's pretty masculine of or pretty confident of you to drink this drink. I was like, what does that mean? So tonight, the Windy City Wine Guy is going to be here. We're going to talk a little bit about rosé being the wine of the summer. I'm ahead of my time, Pete. And I will not shy away. I will stand proud and tell the whole Chicago area and the 17 states that are listening right now that Justin Kaufman is a rosé drinker. Also tonight, the Bulls draft, 14th pick. We'll get Sammy Panjanovic in here to talk about what they get, a point guard to replace Derrick Rose, I'm sure. Also, whether or not Jimmy Butler stays with the Chicago Bulls after tonight. And 10 o'clock hour, are you ready for this swap meet? It's back. Greg Flamm is back. We are going to, everybody's got great Chicago memorabilia. Greg's got the best. Do you think he could top him? You think your stuff is worth anything? Greg will tell you. It's a swap meet coming up at 10 o'clock. News, weather, and traffic with Rob Martier and Esmeralda Leon. Production provided by Pete Zimmerman. I'm Justin Kaufman. This here is The Download, a show about Chicago starring those who know it well. All right, we'll take a break. We'll come back. We'll do the carryout. Stay with us. All right, it's time for the carryout tonight. This, of course, our nightly segment where I read the newspaper so you at home, you don't have to. Here are today's top stories. The two-day Democrat sit-in is over. Quitters. The House Dems are protesting the lack of gun control legislation, specifically the defeat of the measure to deny guns to those on the government's no-fly list, which to me is super interesting because the protest sit-ins of the civil rights era were to secure civil rights. This is to take the civil rights away. Hey, listen, I'm all for gun control, but maybe come up with a piece of legislation that really gets at the heart of it. And when you can't get that passed, protest. Not off something that gives government unlimited power to put people on a list that takes away rights. That's just me. Don't get mad. Carry on. Representative Tammy Duckworth was involved in the sit-in, and when the official cameras were shut off, she was one of the lawmakers that used her phone to broadcast via social media. How did she get her phone past security? Well, she hid it in her prosthetic leg. That move has people calling her a hero, but I don't know. I'm never a huge fan of smuggling contraband into the House chambers. What else does she have in there? I'll bet she's got a ton of unwrapped candy. The U.S. Supreme Court was busy today, ruling that President Obama's immigration executive action was unconstitutional. Well, the court was tied, so they just pushed it back to the last court that ruled, and they ruled that it was unconstitutional. Ah, courts. So what does it mean? It means that millions of immigrants here illegally are subject to deportation, like now. It also sends a message to the president and to Congress that the executive action runaround is unacceptable. So now what? Well, it goes back to Congress, who was like, what? Wait a second, we already got to come up with new gun laws, and now immigration? This job is so hard. Ooh, is that unwrapped candy? Rumors out of Springfield is that a budget deal may be close. Lawmakers have been called back for a session next week, which is peculiar, but it also could be that the state flower vote needs to happen or a proclamation on the best state hamburgers up, so just pay attention. In world politics, the EU vote is happening now. Will the UK leave the EU membership? Man, I wish it was this easy to leave my memberships. I sign up for one Columbia House CD membership and then for the rest of my life. But I did get a couple good Enya CDs. A new ordinance introduced yesterday to City Council would let independent tow truck companies charge you a convenience fee if you pay that $140 tow charge with a credit card. Wow, so not only do you have to deal with a huge charge in the first place and the interest on that payment from your credit card company, but now another fee on top? Can we ask some aldermen to sit in for this? This seems a lot more important. And what alderman puts this forward? Alderman Emma Mitz. What are they giving you? Like a guarantee you'll never be booted? Ridiculous. Unacceptable. No. Sorry. No more. No more fees. In weather, the National Weather Service said 6 tornadoes touched down in Illinois yesterday, a year to the day that a number of tornadoes touched down around Coal City. So let's just go ahead and skip June 22nd in the future. Today, a nice one, a little cloudy, but perfect temp. 90s this weekend. In sports, tonight's the NBA draft. Who will be the point guard that the Bulls pick with the 14th overall? And will they be able to replace Derrick Rose in our hearts? How amazing. A kid from Chicago beats all odds, gets drafted on the Bulls, starts his career with record numbers, full of city love, then he gets hurt, and the city turns on him. It's like an episode of Chicago Fire. I've never seen that show, but yeah. Anyway, Rose is on the Knicks, who have rumored to be interested in Dwight Howard. Anyway, here's hoping that Derrick Rose has all the success in the Big Apple. Good luck finding someone there to take your SAT for you. Only in Chicago. Also, new rumors are emerging that the Knicks are also in play for Kevin Durant. It just makes you wonder. So many teams in the NBA make it look easy, but the Bulls make it look so hard. Also, super annoying, but there are a million rumors swirling that a Jimmy Butler deal could be in the works. So, yeah, you know what? It's 1999 all over again. The White Sox lost in extras today, but took 3 of 4 from the Red Sox at Fenway, but still got to win the close ones to get back in this thing. The Sox are a game under 500, but good start to the summer for the boys in black.
The boys in blue go to South Beach this weekend to take on the Marlins. That should be fun. Little merengue dancing time. It'd be fun to see Joe Maddon out there shaking his hips to Daddy Yankee. Rizzo's not playing tonight. The new ESPN body issue is going to feature naked Jake Arrieta and naked Elena Deladon. That's too bad. I was hoping for a naked Joel Quenneville. But you get what you get. You don't complain. And finally tonight, Led Zeppelin won a copyright infringement case over alleged plagiarizing for the song Stairway to Heaven. This decision was met with disappointment from music lovers everywhere who were hoping that if Zeppelin lost, we would never have to hear that stupid, stupid song ever again. Well, that's the carryout for June 23rd, 2016. Hey, you ordered the fries, right? We just threw them loose in the bag. Eliminate the middleman. Coming up here on The Download, we're going to talk with Erica Wozniak. She's a fifth grade science teacher for CPS. She won the Everyday Hero Award that was given out for the American Federation of Teachers just this month. We'll talk with her about advocating for her students and her school. That's coming up here on The Download, 720 WGN. Stay with us. All right, more to come here on The Download. Rob Martier, how are you, my man?
I am doing well.
So, yeah, so as Ro and Anna and their team do sensory deprivation, I had asked people to text in what they think they should do next. Uh-huh. And someone had a great one. I'll get the number here in just a second. It was naked paintball.
Naked paintball.
Ouch.
See, anything involving nudity, I'm automatically out.
You're out?
I don't even like looking at myself when I get out of the shower.
Rob, it's just, you know, we're just learning each other. You know, we've only worked together for years. So I'm just learning. So anything involving nudity, you're out. Okay, good.
I do, however, take great offense to the notion that Rose team could somehow outdrink us.
Yeah, that's ridiculous.
That will definitely be a challenge.
I mean, Pete Zimmerman's here. That's kind of ridiculous. That's ridiculous.
Crazy.
Yeah. They got some youngsters on that team too.
Yeah.
Violetta and Kevin. So.
And millennials do not know how to pace themselves.
Yeah, exactly. I like our chances.
Me too.
It's a download here on WGN Radio. I'm Justin Kaufman. Coming up at 8 o'clock, The Big Table, the guys behind Closed Sessions, the indie hip-hop record label in Humboldt Park. We'll talk with them coming up. About a lot of things, about working with some of the independent hip-hop artists that are coming through Chicago and making a name for themselves at an explosive rate. I mean, everyone from Chance the Rapper to Vic Mensa to Kwaku Collins, who we had on, Mick Jenkins, so many artists, Saba, who are coming through Chicago's, or up and coming through the ranks of Chicago hip-hop, and they're becoming national just stars. And we'll talk with Closed Sessions, who's been a record label that's been behind a lot of these voices and has helped them early in their career. So that's coming up at 8 o'clock. Also, later tonight, it's a swap meet. You think you got some good Chicago memorabilia? Greg Flam will be here to tell you if you do or you don't. It's pretty simple. Last time we did it, we had such great response. People were calling up saying, I've got a map from 1948. And Greg was amazing. He's like, no, that's not worth anything. It's like it was destroying dreams. But then there were some that called in, and he's like, oh, that's great. I'd buy that off you. That's what Greg does for a living. He resells on eBay and does a lot of auctions, things like that. So Greg will be coming up with swap meet in the 10 o'clock hour. Well, just this week, CPS students, teachers, and administrators said goodbye to the 2015-2016 school year. It schools out for the summer, but this is a critical one for budgets, funding, and, of course, the Chicago Teachers Union, who threatened to strike in the fall. It's hard for those with no skin in the game to understand the chaos and uneasiness surrounding public school these days. But that's not stopping teacher Erica Wozniak for standing up for herself and her students. The American Federation of Teachers announced earlier this month the Everyday Hero Award, and it was given to Wozniak, a fifth grade CPS teacher. She's a science teacher at the neighborhood school Oriole Park Elementary in Norwood Park. She's a self-proclaimed strategic troublemaker. We love that. Who stands up for the rights of her students and her school. Wozniak also co-hosts the onstage talk show at the Hideout called The Girl Talk. Her co-host is Jen Sabella over at DNA Info. Erica Wozniak, welcome to The Download.
Thank you for having me, Justin.
So let's talk about the Everyday Hero Award. I mean, this was a big deal, and the American Federation of Teachers, a national award. Talk about what this means to get this award.
Well, it's a really big deal. I'm extremely honored and also humbled to have it because there's so many people who work in our schools every day who are heroes to our students, and that's really what it's about. So just being there for our students day in and day out, and there's just so many of us who do that. So,
well, let me ask you, what does it mean for you to be a hero? When you say a hero to the Chicago public school kids, what does that mean?
Somebody who's there for my students as individuals and helping them grow and just be good humans. I think that's what that looks like.
Okay, so you've been a teacher for 12 years in the system. Talk about how you got into it, what your first experiences were at CPS, and as opposed to what you have now.
Wow, okay. So I started 10 days out of student teaching. I went to DePaul, and I started at a school called Heffron, which was, just to put it in context, it was on the west side. It was across the street from a coffin factory. And I had a group of fourth grade students who were really great students, great kids, but they were dealt a rough hand in life. A few of them had already been involved in a gang-related shooting.
This is fourth grade.
This is fourth graders. But they were great kids, and I was there, and I would get there at 6 a.m. when the school opened, and I would leave at 7 p.m. with the engineer. And actually, one night I was going home, and I got punched in the back of the head on the bus, but I went back the next day because I wanted to be there. So, you know, this young 21-year-old kid who's just trying to change the world, make a difference. Mm-hmm. But after about a month there, my principal let me go because her friend needed a job. So I got let go, and I ended up at a school called Morton Career Academy. And I taught there for about 4 years. I became the delegate there after just a few months because I found out that there was asbestos in my classroom. So I ended up calling the union, the Chicago Teachers Union, and telling them about it. And while I was, you know, so upset about the situation that my students were learning in a classroom where there was asbestos, which is very timely given, mm-hmm. you know, the lead in the water situation. I called the union, and the union was there the next day. So I immediately became delegate. Marilyn Stewart, who was the president at the time. Yeah, she was there, and she said, you know, you guys don't have a delegate. And I raised my hand, and all the other teachers were looking at me like, girl, you're crazy. You've been teaching here just for a couple of months. You're a first-year teacher. But I wanted to do it because I wanted to advocate for my students.
You spent, you know, the early part of your career advocating for students on the west side. You now are in Norwood Park, which is a little bit more affluent. You're going to get more firefighters and police officers and families around city workers.
Yeah.
What's the difference between teaching at fifth grade at Oriel or fifth grade or fourth grade at Morton?
Well, the big difference is that we have a community that is really invested in our school's community. So they're very invested in making sure that they know what's going on, they're at the schools. And that's not to say that that wasn't happening in other communities. Maybe it was just situational where people in the Norwood Park community can't have 9-to-5 jobs where they can be at school at a certain time or they can take off work and they're not going to lose their job. But very dedicated parents. I mean, if I give out a homework assignment that doesn't make sense, I'm going to get at least 6 emails about it. And I appreciate that about my parents. I mean, right. they're on top of it. I communicate with them regularly and they want that. And, you know, my husband works in Inglewood, and he communicates with his parents very regularly too, but mostly via text, maybe not so much email. And he also, you know, if they have something that's happening at the school, it's harder for them to get parents to come. Like I said, maybe it's situational.
It's a work situation, yeah.
But it's also a buy-in to the school and to the school community, and that's something that Oriel Park really has done a great job of.
And as I mentioned, it's a neighborhood school.
Yes.
I mean, in the way that we've seen so much kind of playing out between selective enrollment, charter schools, magnet schools, and neighborhood schools. Neighborhood schools are almost forgotten because they're the ones that are, you know, are bound by boundaries and are just there. But talk about the pride of winning an award like this for a neighborhood school.
Yeah, well, it's interesting that you say the word pride because that's our whole theme of our school is Panther Pride. So we're the Panthers, the Oriel Park Panthers. So yeah, the pride of winning this award isn't it's more about our school and just making our school a better place. And the students, you know, we have things all over the school that say, you know, have pride in your school, shut your lockers, make sure your classroom is clean at the end of the day. Just having pride in this is where we learn. This is an important place, and maintaining that as well. So for me, I mean, I probably could look at my school staff and I could say that I'm probably the least deserving of the teachers to win this award, because I admire every single thing that every teacher in my school does. And because they're there at 6 a.m. some days and they're until 7 p.m. and they're doing so much for their students. And our school community also really recognizes that.
Erica Wozniak is in studio with me tonight. She's a science teacher at the neighborhood school, Oriole Park Elementary, Panther Pride, in Norwood Park. We'll continue the conversation here on The Download just after the break. Stay with us. It's The Download here on WGN Radio. I'm Justin Kaufman with you till 11 o'clock tonight. My guest in studio, Erica Wozniak. She is a fifth grade science teacher at the neighborhood Chicago Public School, Oriole Park Elementary in Norwood Park. She just won the American Federation of Teachers Everyday Hero Award, and she's also a self-proclaimed strategic troublemaker. Erica, what does that mean?
It means that I'll think about what kind of trouble I'm going to cause before I cause it, so I don't just go out there and start, you know, going crazy.
Well, you
crazy.
Mentioned it. I mean, you're a steward for the school.
Yep.
You've had that experience. So when you talk about strategic troublemaking, it's really about making sure the voice of teachers is heard to the CPS office.
Yeah, and to the city as well. I mean, I think that there's a lot of things that are going on in our city that the general public doesn't always know about and doesn't always think about.
We've seen in recent months, you know, the idea that people that are involved in the union or are outspoken against the mayor may find themselves either taken off the post, reassigned. Do you worry about that as a teacher, being outspoken to issues in schools?
I guess I don't, because I know that what I'm speaking out for is right. I mean, one issue that I've been really outspoken about has been the use of $55 million public tax dollars to buy the land for a stadium for DePaul University, my alma mater. So I know that that's wrong and that's bad for kids. So I'm happy to speak out against that and do whatever I need to do to get my voice heard and believing that. So.
Well, let's talk about some of the other things that you advocate for. Obviously, what I read in you write commentaries at time, op-eds for the Chicago Tribune, one of which was talking about class sizes. This is something I don't think people recognize that happens a lot in CPS. There's a union contract that says that a size of a class is 26 kids, 28 kids, something like that. And more often than not, that's just thrown to the wayside. That's overlooked, looked the other way. And we're seeing in Chicago public schools today, second, third, fourth grade class, especially in some of the higher populated areas, having 36, 38, 40 kids.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, this year was my first year that I had I had 26 students this year. The year before, I had 36 students. And I filed a class size referral every year. And we, our school community was extremely, extremely outspoken about the high class sizes in our school. And eventually, we were one of the North Side schools. I recognize we're a North mm-hmm. Side school that got an addition. So that's how our class size was able to be reduced, because of the, you know, additional space of having the addition. But having the 26 students, like, this year, on the first day, I know I wrote that I kind of had to step out and sort of have a moment for myself where I cried a little bit, because I felt that this is what these students deserve. You know, I mean, I was able to get to know all of their names by the first hour of the day and get to know them so much better as human beings than the year before, to be honest, because I had 36. I had 10 more kids, a third more kids to learn and get to know as learners and as people and all those other things. I mean, that's a lot in the space.
Right.
I mean, you're thinking 36 10-year-olds in a small classroom. That's, I mean, that's a lot of bodies.
Yeah, right. Not to mention a lot of smells.
We talk a lot about that.
Well, let's talk. I mean, the other issues, too, are namely about resources. I mean, you're seeing this across. I mean, we're obviously having a huge budget fight about what can be cut and what can't be cut school by school. But it's bigger than that, because Oriole Park has the same issues as a lot of other schools when it comes to just the space in itself is getting stretched, where you have to make decisions on whether or not the library is going to double as the art room, or if, you know, the cafeteria is also going to be a classroom. You know, there's a lot of things that have to be decided by at the school level that I think a lot of parents and people who aren't necessarily in Chicago Public Schools don't ever think about.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you see this great exodus of principals this year alone, and the principals have to get so unbelievably creative with their budgets, because the budgets are terrible right now. I mean, the per pupil spending that we've gone to, and I don't even know if they're going to do it this year, this upcoming school year, assuming we open. But it's really bad. And even what people don't understand is we've gotten a lot of new students this year. In fifth grade alone, we've gotten a lot of new students. And each time we get a new student, we don't get the funding that goes along with that student. So if I have a student who transfers into my classroom after the 20th day of school, we don't get the measly $4,100 that comes along with that student. So we still have to provide for that student without getting the funding. And let's say they came from another neighborhood school in CPS, that school would then have the funding. So when students transfer in, we just have an additional body and an additional person that we need to teach without the funding.
There's so many issues that are, you know, that we can talk about. And let's get to some of the ones that I'm curious about. You know, when you think about being in the starting 12 years ago, do you see Chicago Public Schools moving in an upward trajectory, or do you see it moving in a downward trajectory from your vantage point as a teacher, 12-year teacher?
I see it moving in this current moment in a downward trajectory. However, I've seen ebbs and flows. Right now, I think our biggest issue is just our elected officials who just don't seem to care about Chicago Public School students. And that's the bottom line, specifically our governor. And also, I mean, our mayor has proven that he doesn't seem to care too much as well, although I'm sure he would disagree with me on that.
Well, I mean, that obviously is into the next question about politics. Obviously, schools have become politics. We've seen arguments in the state house about, even today we saw Governor Rauner talking about bailout, the word bailout, to give money to Chicago Public Schools. He will say Chicago messed up their funding. It's not fair for them to get more funding than someone else in the state. For you as a teacher, as a steward, as someone who's in the classroom, do you pay attention to those that kind of rhetoric, to the politics that are playing out about whether or not, you know, schools will be funded?
Yeah, I mean, I pay attention to it very much. Do I worry about it? Yes, but I can't, to an extent that I still have to worry about the 26 students who are in my classroom and what's going to happen next year. And I still have to plan my lessons and figure out what I'm going to teach and make sure that I'm the best teacher that I can be. But yeah, absolutely. I pay a lot of attention to it. And I pay a lot of attention to who's doing what and who's voting where. And I really, you know, that's something that's been very important to me in these last few years, specifically after the mayoral election.
All right. So two more questions and we'll wrap up here. One, so many times we'll have a conversation about politics and schools, and I will get texts and I'll get the devil's advocate about the teachers. You know what? They want more money. They're going to strike for more money. Don't they get paid enough? In Chicago Public Schools, they get paid way too much. I mean, talk about that sentiment, the sentiment that teachers are in some way greedy or that get paid more than they should here in the city of Chicago.
Well, I think that's ridiculous. I think it's a complete misnomer that in any of the recent years we've asked for more money, because in fact we've not gotten our raises under this current mayoral administration. And in our current contract negotiations, we haven't actually asked for a raise. So that's a complete misnomer. And as far as teachers making too much money, I don't I really don't understand that, because I'm spending 8 hours a day with the people who are going to eventually be in charge of our city. And in my opinion, all of these other issues that we have in America could be solved with quality public education. And the first place that you start with that is by treating our teachers like the professionals that they are, with master's degrees and people who spend 8 to 10 hours a day with children. I mean, come on.
All right, this will be the last question. I'll let the texter, great text came in, said, I'm a retired, I'm an elementary education major. Okay, so they're in school. And I want to teach because I want to help, besides having a positive attitude. How do I change the negative attitude of my future peers? They seem so down. The question I seem to get most is, are you sure when I say I want to be a teacher? So, I mean, do you notice that? Do you notice that it almost becomes a difficult proposition to recruit new teachers, but also to be a teacher?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, exactly what you just said. There's this, I don't know when the dialogue became switched over that teachers are the enemy and teachers are the bad guy, because that's absolutely not the case. So what I would tell that person, you are going to change the world, because you're going to do it one student at a time, and you should never give up on that, because every year I've taught, and in my 12th year, every year I say this is the best year of my life. And typically I was just saying this to a friend, on the last day of school, I still get sad. Like, I'm not one of those, you know, I go out and maybe have, you know, libations after the last day of school, but I'm sad on the last day because I'm leaving these little people that I have fallen in love with over the course of 180 days that I've spent with them. I mean, it's really a beautiful thing. So you should do it. Become a teacher. And don't worry about what anybody else says, because I don't.
Erica Wozniak is the Everyday Hero Awardee from the American Federation of Teachers. She's a fifth grade CPS science teacher at the neighborhood school, Oriole Park Elementary in Norwood Park. Erica, thanks for being my guest tonight.
Thank you so much for having me, Justin.
This is Chicago's very own 720 WGN Chicago and WGNRadio.com. You can check out the show. I forgot to mention the show Girl Talk. She co-hosts, Erica Wozniak and Jen Sabella do the Girl Talk, which is at the Hideout. Their next show is going to be on the 28th of June, 6:30. I think that's a Tuesday night. Imani Boyette, who is a star of the Chicago Sky, who is on this program, will be their guest. That'll be fun.
Let's go, Bulls. 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 Let's go, Bulls.
It's a download here on WGN Radio. I'm Justin Kaufman. Wow. Well, we start off the night here, of course, with Mr. Simmons out of LSU going number one in the NBA draft. Well, the Chicago Bulls were just on the clock. You know what that means. That means Sam Panionovich is going to join us here from WGN Radio. Sam, who did the Bulls pick with the 14th pick?
The pick is in. Denzel Valentine, a forward from Michigan State. He spent a lot of years in the Big Ten. He got better every season. 19 points a game last year, 8 assists, 7 rebounds. He had a bunch of triple-doubles. A well-rounded weapon for Gar Foreman and John Paxson here. But that hasn't really been the story, as we've all been following the Jimmy Butler storyline. Is he going to be traded or not? That's been, you know, 1A tonight. But right now the Bulls haven't made a deal yet. But they have settled with the 14th pick, Denzel Valentine from Michigan State.
What does this mean? Obviously, there was a lot of eyes on the Chicago Bulls picking a point guard, someone to run the point, because Derrick Rose was shipped to New York. But Denzel Valentine is a small forward, big guy, 6'7", 6'8". What does it mean that they picked this guy?
Well, he actually ran point guard a lot last year for Tom Izzo. He's a versatile player. He can pretty much play 2-3 positions, including point guard. So he is a ball handler. I don't know if the Bulls are done making moves yet. They still might flip Jimmy Butler to Minnesota. That's been rumored. But Valentine's a guy that can do a lot. As we mentioned, he averaged a triple-double, I think, for a 2-week stretch in Big Ten play, and he's been putting up numbers. But I don't know that this is a point guard, you know, per se, that you're gonna roll with, especially because of all the concerns. This is so interesting. The Bulls just traded a point guard with knee injuries.
That's
and Denzel Valentine has knee issues.
So he was There was talk of him being a lot higher on the draft board earlier in the sort of analyst, but he did sort of have some knee issues that came out saying he might have some trouble. It's the suspect in his knees. It dropped him down. What does that mean for the Chicago Bulls to take a player who already has health issues before he's even in the NBA?
It's a head scratcher for me. I thought they'd go with Wade Baldwin from Vanderbilt, who is a much more true point guard. He's been playing that position his whole life. This one, you know, it's best player available, but there are some risks. So what does it mean going forward? The Bulls are going to roll the dice because they feel like he is a top 15 talent. But as we know, some of these players go up, some of them go down, some of them never really see the floor. So we'll just have to wait and see when Valentine gets in here, starts working out, and we get a better scene as to what he's really like and how strong those knees really are.
Well, we're familiar with him because of his play in the Big Ten, obviously with Michigan State. He's a big guy, and he was a star among boys when it comes to college basketball. You saw him on the defensive side of the ball being somewhat electric, and he also, like you said, he had triple-doubles up the wazoo. I mean, is this the kind of player that if nothing happened yesterday with Derrick Rose and there were no rumors with Jimmy Butler, is this the kind of player who hits the floor and starts automatically?
No, I don't think so. He's going to come in off the bench no matter who's on the roster. I don't think that Fred Hoiberg's in a rush-type situation where you have to put Valentine on the floor. He's not a top-three pick. There's no urgency to get him out there before he's ready. But I do think this is a player, Justin, that got better every single year in East Lansing. They saw progression from freshman to sophomore on a junior year, and they feel like he is a winning player. Even though Michigan State got bounced in the first round of the tournament this year to a 15 seed, they think that Denzel Valentine can come in. He's a good leader. He can play some point guard. He defends well. And he's got a good college pedigree, played in a good program under a really good head coach.
So, sounds familiar, right? That's what John Paxson likes to do. Gar Forman, they like to get these guys from established programs.
Well, and I'm not going to compare Draymond Green and Denzel Valentine, but their utility belts are similar in that they can defend a lot of positions. They can do a lot of things with the basketball. They move well without it. They can shoot it. So there's a lot of versatility with Denzel Valentine, and that's something that a lot of scouts saw in Draymond Green once upon a time, and he has been a piece on a championship basketball team. So that's the plan here. Now the only other question is, will Jimmy Butler be a Bull by the night's end? I still think that he's staying in Chicago. I didn't think the returns were good enough in Boston. The Minnesota one, I get this inkling that Tom Thibodeau is just toying with them. Like, you know, he's calling them and telling them, like, he'll do the deal, and then they call back, and he says, I don't know, maybe.
Well, let me ask you, Sam, what are some of the deals that, I mean, the rumor mill is, I know we heard Minnesota, we heard the Lakers at some point, we heard Boston, but what is the going rate for Jimmy Butler? What are they throwing at the Bulls to try and get Jimmy Butler out?
Supposedly, according to Adrian Wojnarowski from The Vertical with Yahoo, he said that the package that was last brought to the table was the number 5 pick, which was just done, and then Zach LaVine, the guy who won the dunk contest a couple years in a row, athletic winger. That was supposedly the package, and if that's what the Bulls were offering for a top 15 player in Jimmy Butler, that is just stupid. You need more for Jimmy. You need a pick. You need a couple controllable assets. I don't think that's enough. And, I mean, you don't just trade him just to trade him because it's cool. You know, he's still a very good player with a controllable contract. The cap is going up, but his contract is locked in around $17, $18, $19 million the next couple of years. So I wouldn't trade him unless you get at least 3 warm bodies back. You're not going to do it for 2.
Is this an issue where the NBA teams around the league smell blood in the water, meaning they think that the Bulls are looking for a fire sale after what happened with Derrick Rose yesterday, and they might be raising the white flag, so they're trying to lowball the Bulls and to try and get rid of Jimmy Butler?
I think that's the case, but I would hope that Bulls management is smart enough to know that they don't have to trade Jimmy Butler right now. They still have him for 4 more seasons. And unless they're completely wowed away by an offer where you can get a couple guys and then maybe a couple picks, there's no reason, there's no rush to just dump him just because you're going to dump him. That being said, though, can you imagine being Jimmy Butler the last 2 hours? Hmm. You're sitting around looking at your phone, talking to your agent, and wondering, am I going to be traded? Am I not?
Right.
There was already a fallout between Butler and the Bulls, and now if you dangle your best player for the last 2 hours on draft night and then have to bring him back into your services, that's going to be an awkward relationship.
And the day after they sort of anointed him to be the leader of this team with the trade of Derrick Rose, this isn't what you necessarily do to the leader.
No, it's not not A-plus communication skills, but not exactly surprising either. I do see people on their phones left and right. I'm going to head back inside. Maybe Jimmy was traded since we've been on the phone. I'm going to check it out.
All right, sounds good. Sam Panionovich, WGN Radio. If he is traded, give us a ring back. We'll get you updated here on WGN Radio. Thanks, Sam.
You got it.
It's always fun to be able to bring you immediate draft analysis, regardless of the sport. Baseball draft isn't as exciting as, say, the NFL draft or the NBA draft. Both of these nights are special. It's interesting. I'm an NBA basketball fan. I have a lot of friends who are like, I like college. I'm a purist, but I like the NBA. I think that's why the idea that the Chicago Bulls are, you know, getting rid of Derrick Rose and possibly Jimmy Butler. It's unsettling because the one thing that's terrible about the NBA is when a team is rebuilding. There's just not, it's just like going out there and you just see them getting trounced. And we did that. We did that from 1999 to 2007.
Yeah.
And there were a couple of times maybe, Kurt Heinrich and Ben Gordon went to the playoffs with Ben Wallace. It was like first round. I mean, there was one where they went a couple rounds. But those were not teams that
you felt like they couldn't win the championship.
Right. It's just, I don't know. I was thinking about this earlier. Like if you're the Chicago Bulls and you have a bunch of pieces, Pau Gasol, Jimmy Butler, a couple of second, third year guys that are serviceable. Joakim Noah is a free agent, right? What, in this day and age when the Golden State Warriors are breaking records and the Cleveland Cavaliers are beating them with LeBron James, who's probably got about five more years left in the league, does that make your strategy obvious? Meaning, do you go, okay, you know what? We're not going to win. Derek's got 7 years left on his legs, maybe less. We're not going to win. So let's fire sale and get a bunch of rookies in here that can trip over themselves and learn how to play basketball. So when we get to the fifth year, when LeBron James is on his Dwayne Wade tour, you know, or the Kobe Bryant tour, the East opens up and the Bulls are poised and mature and ready to win a championship.
That's a good point.
It's a huge long gamble.
I hate to think that that's how an organization thinks.
Right.
I mean, I want to win now.
Yeah, and it's not, I guess for me as a fan of the game of basketball and the Chicago Bulls, I don't think that should be an expectation that I temper. They should be in the hunt for the NBA championship every single year. This is Chicago. This is the third largest market. This is the house that Jordan built. We should be on with Ahmad Rashad on the sideline and, you know, and it counts. That's what we do. You built this, Jerry Reinsdorf. You built this, you know, the Chicago Bulls organization. You can't then say, yeah, well, we're going to, for the next 20 years, we're going to rebuild for 13 of those.
What my problem is, because the Cubs went through the same thing in the kind of the rebuilding process, but I was all in on Theo and the group. Right. I am not all in on Gar Pax. I'm not sure if that's the group.
And, you know, the one thing about the Chicago Cubs is the expectation was, I mean, they made a huge move, what, now 4 or 5 years ago to get Theo Epstein. That was a move that said, hey, we're starting here and we're moving. The move with us and the Chicago Bulls has been Fred Hoiberg. And you're like, well, he doesn't, that's not a winning proposition in a sense. Then nothing against Coach Hoiberg, but he's not won in the NBA.
Mm-hmm.
He hasn't coached at the NBA level. He's not a guy like Steve Kerr, who has already had success, not only winning championships. I mean, I think six or three with the Bulls and three with the Spurs. And then on top of it, a general manager. You know, like he had a lot before they decided to make him a Golden State Warrior head coach. But to me, it just feels like with Theo, he's coming off a world championship. He brought, you know, a legacy to Boston. So hiring him and spending the money to hire him, you're like, okay, we're in good hands. You know what? You do what you do with Samardzija.
Right? Yeah.
That's okay.
And I was fine with a couple of lean, well, actually it turned out really only like 1.5 lean years. you know, the rebuild happened a little bit sooner. So I understand the concept of, hey, all right, you know, we're not going to beat LeBron. Let's try to refocus, retool, as Gar said. I don't trust them. They don't have a good track record.
And it's too bad, because if you really look at how successful the Chicago Bulls have been and the under Gar Foreman and John Paxson, they have been. You know, besides the, I mean, what we've had a problem with is there's been a lot of strange dust-ups. There's been the friction between Coach Thibs, right? Where you're like, why is there friction? He won 62 games. He's winning. Derrick Rose is out, and they're winning 58 games.
Yeah, going to the playoffs every year.
Yeah, I mean, I don't understand the friction. There should be friction that your star is out. I understand that, and that's a bad, bad draw. Then the friction with Derrick Rose, the friction with Jimmy Butler, the friction with Joakim Noah. And there's a lot of friction. And that's never a good thing when you're like, a fan of you know, turning on the TV and you're like, the Bulls are on. That's all I want. Oh, the Bulls are on. Oh, Derrick Rose is playing. Cool. I don't want to be able to open up Twitter and be like, sources inside the locker room. You're like, oh, man, come on. Now, here, I just got a text. 616 says, huge MSU fan here. Don't complain. You got Denzel Valentine. That is huge.
Great.
And, you know, and I was just saying Dave Ennett would know this, and he'll probably talk about this on Cochran tomorrow morning. You know, doing the Northwestern games, you know, you would have an understanding of how dominant Denzel Valentine was in the Big Ten. Now, they got bounced in the tournament first round. That's, Sam mentioned that.
Tell me about it.
That's exactly ruined my night. I'm going to the final two. But, you know, the idea being that, you know, that guy was a bona fide college basketball star. And I do give credit to Gar Foreman and to John Paxson to say, okay, this guy can carry a team. This guy has shown to be a superstar when the lights are bright at Michigan State. And Michigan State's no slouch.
No.
In the way that they're playing NBA-like basketball. The players that play at Michigan State usually go on and play in the NBA.
Like you mentioned, Mateen Cleaves.
Did another 14th round pick. The other person, 847, says, I don't understand why the Bulls would be tempted to trade Jimmy Butler. It just doesn't make sense. You know, I think what that means is that goes right back to what we're just talking about with friction. A lot of friction around Jimmy Butler.
Uh-huh.
You know, arguing with calling the coach out. And he's got problems with Rose. He's got problems with Noah. He's got problems all over. It's like, wait a second. I thought this kid was like, you remember Jimmy Butler's first year with the Bulls, maybe rookie year or maybe his second year, where he was like a defensive juggernaut, but he couldn't score.
Mm-hmm.
Remember that?
Yeah.
It was very strange. And that's when they would like, Jimmy Butler's playing 78 minutes a game. You're like, what? Like, how is this possible? And guarding LeBron James, but that's all he did.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you think about that guy to the guy now who's like the guy who carries the team. I hope he loses that weird friction. I guess that's the word for the night, friction. Right? So I don't know. I hope, you know, in a weird way, I've been like, seeing the same things that 847 said, it doesn't make sense to me. But I'm also like, maybe Jimmy Butler is a pain in the side. Maybe Jimmy Butler can be traded for some assets that puts together a nucleus of a team that in 5 years is competing against a LeBron-less Cavaliers.
I was reading something on the train because I bummed out a little bit about Derrick Rose.
Yeah.
I don't even know why I was, but I was. And I was reading a piece, I don't know where it was, but it was like six things to be excited about the Bulls getting rid of Derrick Rose. And because I'm a dummy, you know, I believe, like, I'll read something and I'm like, yeah, this guy's totally right. Then I'll read something else. I'm like, yeah, this guy's totally right. And I was getting excited. I'm like, yeah, these are great points. Oh my God, yes, Bobby Portis is going to be a star in this league. And then, you know, I'm like, all right, I'm on top of this. And then I read like the first comment, you know, it's like, what are you, Bulls PR? All right, maybe.
It is. I mean, that is a problem, right? The idea that all these guys have no. I mean, Denzel Valentine, great player, Michigan State, but like Sam said, trouble with his knees. You never want to hear that from a guy who gets picked in the first round in the NBA draft.
Yeah,
especially because you just got rid of a guy with wonky knees.
Right, exactly. That's the last thing we need. Is like, we made the playoffs. Oh, I got hurt in the playoffs. Oh no. And you know, it's not just that either. I mean, the Bulls have been, and you kind of mentioned last night, Pete. The Bulls have been very fragile. Maybe Coach Thibodeau had something to do with running those players, Luol Deng, mm-hmm. as a reminder.
That is such
Noah.
A load.
Here we go.
Come on, you guys. These guys are pampered at every turn. They stay in five-star hotels. They fly chartered flights. They're fragile. If you're fragile and you've ascended to the NBA, maybe you shouldn't be in the NBA.
Well, if one coach is going harder than every other coach, and I don't know if that's the case, but that's what seemed to be in the rumor mills, and it didn't matter, and you're teaching
well,
like it's a high school. Well, that, all we're saying is that's when you get a freak, oh, I've got a hyperextension of an ankle because we were practicing so hard.
Uh-huh.
That's what you don't want. That's what you want. You want to save that stuff and say what you will about LeBron James, but I felt LeBron James this year, he's matured in the way that he's not there. There'll be stretches where the Cavs are not doing well in November, January, right? Where they're like, oh, what's wrong with the Cavs? And then he's like, all right, now I'm going to get in shape. Now I'm going to get, you know, my head on. And then they go like crazy in the playoffs and win the championship. In the Bulls, it's always been the other way. They like fight hard to beat the Bucks on a Tuesday night in January. And then they get to the playoffs and they break down. Everybody's hurt and everybody's tired and everybody's gassed. And
when you like, go to the United Center and pay $80 per ticket to watch these guys play basketball, you better damn well be certain that they're going to give 100%.
Yeah,
so I think they're probably giving 100%, but their 100% is not 100% because they're gassed. They feel like they're, you know, like...
Right.
The two of you. What am I going to do with the two of you?
The hockey, you know, the hockey season going 2 months extra, I think that weighs on an athlete's body, no matter how hard they're fighting.
I will grant you that, absolutely. But you are paid to do that.
My tears, mad.
I'm fired up now. I got a burr under my saddle. Forget it.
All right, let's take a break. We'll get to the news, and then coming up, we'll talk with the guys from Closed Session. Stay with us. See, she's welcome back to Download here on WGN Radio. I'm Justin Kaufman. Well, the independent hip-hop record label Closed Sessions doesn't mince words. The label believes that Chicago is the hip-hop capital of the world, and nobody understands that hip-hop scene better than Alex Fruchter and Mike Kolar. They're the men behind the label that has worked with great artists like Wyclef, Raekwon, Chance, Vic Mensa, and Action Bronson, just to name a few. And they serve as an instrumental part of Chicago music, helping artists create, work, and grow before they're thrown to the major label music industry wolves. Alexander Fruchter and Mike Kolar are the founders, and they're with me in studio tonight. Guys, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you. Yeah, it's good to be here.
Let's start right there. I mean, we've had so many hip-hop artists in here, and we've had some of your artists. Kwaku Collins was in here. A lot of people who've been with you guys have been on the program. But why don't we start with the idea that Chicago is the best hip-hop town in the world? Why don't we start with that premise? Go.
I agree totally. I think why Chicago is that town is where artists in Chicago are just concerned with making, I feel, initially great art. While when I talk to, like, when Odd Future was at the studio and they're in L.A. and they see the houses and the hills and the industry, sometimes that can have a mildly perverse effect on your motives and, like, what you're creating. And while Chicago, there is no Atlantic Records building and there is no Viacom building, I think it allows for a much purer motive in the initial music creation, and also kind of being very separated from L.A. and New York distance-wise, and Atlanta and other music meccas, it allows us to kind of have our own space to make a very unique Chicago sound.
And you've mentioned before the idea that if you were in New York trying to start up a label, you know, it'd be a multi-million dollar venture. I mean, that's very difficult to do in a place like New York City where there are some tremendous record labels. But here in Chicago, there really hasn't been a record label that lays claim to hip-hop. So you guys.
There definitely were some that I think that's where Mike and I have drawn some inspirations from. I mean, for me, growing up in Hyde Park and seeing the All Naturals and the Mole Men's, they kind of presented a certain sound and a certain DIY attitude, but they didn't really continue into the digital age or when the music industry really shifted. They're not around anymore, and I think that's disappointing. I remember, like, you know, talking to Mike about this stuff way back and, like, one day looking up, like, Mole Men doesn't really do anything anymore. All Natural doesn't really do anything anymore. And there were others here and there. But, yeah, like, I think we're trying to take what they started and push it all the way.
What did you guys know? What did you know about record labels before you did this? I mean, when you got together and you said, let's do closed sessions, what was your experience at that point, and what did you know about being a record executive?
I probably just knew what I knew from watching, like, Behind the Music and reading the different books, watching a ton of hip-hop documentaries. And then I think going to these label offices, because I have been a writer, I was a journalist since I was, you know, 18, 19 years old. So I would go to some of the record labels in New York, but on a much different mission. To me, as a DJ, like, the label was the stamp, the cosign, the, like, that was your team, that was the cool thing to be a part of, but had no real true idea, I guess, in hindsight.
After sitting in a recording studio for the last 20 years
right,
of my life,
right?
And seeing it from the other side, I, you know, it was never any wonder to me why I started seeing the major label system collapse. And I was doing Rhymefest album for J Records, and the conference call today was going over what the agenda was set for last week instead of, like, wanting to figure out what we're doing this week, you know. So it was it looked like I ever had a chance to have a label, like, this is exactly how I'm not going to do it. So I didn't know anything about how to do it right. I just saw a lot of things done wrong and wanted to do it in a different way.
Well,
I knew nothing.
Let's ask. I want to ask about, like, what did you guys what did you want to bring when you started Closed Session 7 years ago? What did you guys want to bring to the Chicago scene?
Part of it is when I would be talking to interviewing an artist when I was working, like, at a website, the label was like this all-powerful Wizard of Oz type of thing. And I think what we wanted to bring partly was getting rid of some of that and having accessibility and not kind of coming into a scene and then reporting on it or coming in and seeing what's what. It's like we're coming from the inside and then going outward. That's what we wanted to bring with Closed Sessions as well. That's why you'll see our earliest works were like bringing an artist into Chicago and then putting them in our, you're coming into our studio. Mm-hmm. You're going to work with another Chicago producer or a Chicago rapper that we're going to put on. And these guys are going to, like, through this vessel, the message is going to spread nationally.
You know, I was reading some stuff. You've mentioned other independent record labels like Rhymesayers out of Minneapolis or Ruckus Records.
Yeah.
Were those inspirations for you when I'm trying to think about record labels that have done what you guys are doing?
100%.
We always were like, why is a world-class city of Chicago, why don't we have these awesome, what I call incubator-level labels that New York has with Duck Down and Raucous and Minneapolis has with Rhymesayers and Stone's Throw and all these other cities have these great incubators to get artists to a point where they can actually work a major label system. Like, why don't we have this? And that's a big factor of why a lot of earlier rap pioneers had to leave Chicago, you know, to get on. So that was a big part of our desire.
And also, those labels, what's so cool about them is that they also came to organize a certain time period. It wasn't just like random artists making music under a certain brand name. It was like real community-based. You would look at Rocket stuff and like all the artists were on all the projects. It seemed like they genuinely hung out and created with each other. Rocket symbolized a certain New York hip-hop in a certain time period. Stone's Throw came with one wave and introduced a whole group of Cali artists, but not LA, like Oxnard and around there and that sound. Mm. And then they did it again in a second generation with introducing the Mayor Hawthorne, Aloe Black. They're still going. You have Rhymesayers with Atmosphere and Brother Ali, and they introduced a whole Minneapolis scene as well as a certain DIY work ethic that's been like blueprinted. Mm-hmm. So we want, that's like what is so inspiring about these labels. And that's what we were seeing in Chicago. And we were there ready, passionate to document and organize it.
Well, let's talk more about that. Let's take a quick break. In studio with me, Alex Fuchter and Mike Kohler. They're the men behind the record label Closed Sessions, the hip hop label here in Chicago. We'll take a break and we'll come back and continue the conversation. Stay with us.
In the eye of a storm, you're the only belief that I have found safety. Within the night, I reformed to the norm that you and I created. And so I typed a text to someone that I loved. I'm hungover, Sam. Something told me not. Settle when it's time. Catch your falling high.
When we trip, don't fall. We just drift through.
Welcome back to the download here on WGN Radio. My guests in studio, Alex Fuchter and Mike Kolar, they're the founders of the hip-hop record label Closed Sessions. We had Kwaku Collins in here not too long ago, great kid from Evanston, Illinois. Jamila Woods, who's also been on the program, has got a new record that's coming out pretty soon here. Who do you want on Closed Sessions? When you talk to, you talk about Raucous Records and the others, they built a sound, a raucous sound. What's the Closed Session sound?
The Closed Session sound is one that I think when you try to pinpoint it, it's a foundation of, for lack of a better word, like true school hip-hop or golden era kind of. I think that's where all the artists on our label find a certain common ground and like an inspiration, but then it's taken in a different direction. So it's almost like the core sound interpreted and taken out to different ways. That's the best way I could describe it, like indie in the sense of a genre, like it is indie hip hop, like no necessarily rules, but grounded in this
sensibility
and style. Definitely there's elements of like, we don't have any club bangers like that on the label, which, you know, we just don't. The artists that are making music on our label are really like trying to make songs, like statement songs. I don't know.
They're craftsmen. I mean, they're definitely, we don't have like the quick throwaway top 40 artists. Like, these artists are really focused on their craft. They take it deadly serious. They live in these studios and really are trying to like make very authentic, unique, and best of all, like uncopyable music. So
I read the Tribune article that was just this put out with you guys just a couple weeks ago, and Andrew Barber had a good point about you guys are trying to find artists that are really about their craft and that are thinking about the long term as opposed to trying to get rich quick.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's true, and I think Barber is someone that's seen that whole growth. Mm-hmm. And Closed Sessions is not relying on the next internet sensation necessarily. Like, I think that just comes from, I want to be doing Closed Sessions till I retire, you know.
Yeah.
I'm not trying to find an artist, make a lot of money, and then just give up. Like, I want to have this label. I would love if I have kids and they ran Closed Sessions when
That'd
I
be
decided
awesome.
To quit. That's what we're trying to do, and we want artists that want to be a part of that, artists that when they sign, when you ask, like, who do we want on Closed Sessions, it's got to be someone that actually wants to be on Closed Sessions, not just looking for a manager or looking for a way to accelerate their career. Those are all great, but it's got to be someone that specifically, I want to join this team, I want to work with these people, I want to reach the goals with these people.
We've talked about the artists, but talking about you two as businessmen, like the concept of keeping Closed Sessions as an independent record label. I mean, there are times when record labels get too big. They sign too many people or they're looking to become a major, you know, in some way. Do you guys have to keep yourself grounded and not go for that temptation of growing the business too big?
I mean, yeah. I mean, of course, like, there's so much great talent in Chicago that I wish I could take on every great artist here and help with their career. But we are a self-funded small business. We only have 3 recording studios. There's only so much, you know, only so many hours in the day. So, of course, that temptation is there. But I think when we leave the office after a 12-hour day, it's ameliorated quite a bit to, you know, work with.
I think we've gotten better at that.
Yes.
You know, we've definitely found our lane more or less and decided, kind of like got rid of saying yes to everything and trying to do everything. I think that just comes with growth in general.
I don't know much about, you know, how an artist gets signed, but the things that I do know, that kind of, I guess what you would call like the layman's take, is that an artist is going to send in a tape. You guys are listening like, this is the best I've ever heard. You sign the artist, the Whirlwind. Next thing you know, they're Kanye West or whatever it is. But how does it work when you're trying to engage and sign an artist?
As funny as that sounds, it's kind of shockingly accurate.
Yeah.
I think every artist on our roster like initially reached out to us, you know.
Well, they kind of all come in different ways. Boathouse was an intern at Soundscape, and for months he didn't even tell us he produced, because he just was, that's the kind of person he is. Like, he's like, I'm here to intern for Soundscape, I'm not here to play beats. His mind was like, they'll hear about it. Sure enough, we heard about it, and that was like, we just loved working with him as an intern to studio employee to like, we want to sign you. Yeah. Odd Couple produced some records. That was like a natural, he just started using studio a lot.
So they got to catch your ear in
they
some
catch
form,
our
right?
ear, and I'd say we hang out with them multiple times. Kwaku was kind of like the first one that sent in a demo, and I was just like, okay, this is that was just like, I swear to God, like the sun just shone down on my in me and my computer, like, oh, when I hit that SoundCloud page. It's like, this is the dude, like this is the guy. That we've been talking about and looking for a long time. And
young kid out of Evanston, Illinois.
He was 18 when he shot that In the Dark email.
And then with Jamila, ran into Kevin Koval at a party, and he was like talking about, you know, Jamila is trying to find a recording home. We met with her to talk about recording, and then Boathouse and I, a couple, were there and played her some music, and she vibed and like felt comfortable in our little C room, and that just was a natural thing. It all comes in different ways, but I say all of it is like an organic thing. And then when we actually hang out with the people, there's no like awkwardness or we have to like impress you or you have to impress us. It's like, okay, we get what you're about. We think we can make some great music together. And like, again, it is also about they want to see Closed Sessions succeed, and we want to see them succeed.
And now that we actually have a pretty decent sized roster, it's also like, not only does Alex and I need to like it, like how do you fit in with everyone else?
It's an ensemble,
The squadly vibes must be copacetic for everybody. So there might be someone Sunday where Alex and I, we love this artist, but if it's not going to fit into, we have a very family run, you know, thing. If it's not going to fit into that, no matter how great we think they are,
well, that's interesting because you know when you think of Def Jam or any of the Sony Music, I mean, there's so many label mates. You know, that don't really ever hang out, or they just they're on the same label because it's such a big deal. Yeah. You guys are a family kind of focused record label where they're not only signed, but they're part of an ensemble and they're part of a crew that hangs out together.
We do hang out with each other. All the guys were at my wedding. Whenever we go out, like, or are looking to do stuff, this may sound sad, but it is like us calling each other, kind of like, what do you want to do?
What do you want to do?
And it's reliant on, I mean, literally, it reminds me of that movie Zero Dark Thirty about tracking down Osama bin Laden and the woman that's the head of this little 5-man team. And like the director of CIA comes in and is like, where is that? Like, this is it. It's up to you five. There is no one else.
Yeah, right.
No one's coming.
There's no Delta Force 5 on the stealth bomb. It's like, no, it is just you guys. Whoever's at this table is going to make this work or not. Yeah. And it's just like that scene in the movie, I feel. So that's why it's so important that everybody, you know, or when we're sitting in a car for 14 hours coming back from New York or something, like, it's very important.
Yeah, you got to get along.
We all like each other.
Mike Kohler, Alex Richter, they're the guys behind Closed Sessions. Thanks for joining us. It's a download here on WGN Radio. I'm Justin Kaufman with you till 11 o'clock tonight when Patty Vasquez takes over with Pretty Late Patty Vasquez. All right, you know what? I'll admit it. I'm coming out of the closet here. I didn't want to do this live on the radio, but I am a rosé drinker. Let it sink in. I drink rosé. I love the way it tastes. It's chilled. It's refreshing. As Erica Wozniak, who was on the show a little bit earlier, she called it summer water. I agree with that. Rosé, of course, is nothing new. It's growing in the States as more and more people are consuming the cousin of the white wine. Joining me in studio to talk about a life in wine, and I don't know why we haven't done this earlier, in the sense that I feel like we've pretty much talked about food and beer, but we have yet to talk about wine in this program. In studio, the Windy City wine guy, Michael Botelliero. He's a certified sommelier and wine consultant. You can find his work at windycitywineguy.com. Michael, good to see you. Thanks for being here.
Hey, thank you.
I kind of joke, and I mentioned it earlier on the show. I was on a wine tasting in California, and I ordered the rosé flight, and I kind of got my masculinity questioned. Like, the guy was like a pretty confident guy, huh? Going with the rosé. Don't let anyone see this in public. I was like, what? It's rosé. Everybody drinks rosé, right? So what? I mean, but it is true. Right now, rosé is kind of hot.
It's not even on the rise anymore. I mean, it has risen, so it's beyond that. It's really popular drink. Pink, everybody loves it. It's the chic thing to do. beautiful people drinking beautiful wine and beautiful places.
That's me.
There we go. See? And I mean, over 300 million gallons are consumed per year of rosé. And I mean, you can find them from almost any country, any red grape varietal. It's just really tasty, and it pairs well with a lot of foods. Great summer drink. So, like,
I mean, when I say it's a cousin of white wine, should I say it more? Is it more accurate to say it's a cousin of the red wine?
No, I think you hit it on the head because it's chilled just like the whites. I think of it as like with your white wines, how you get more of the like tropical fruit flavors, maybe citrus fruit flavors. But I think it's the same beverage, but on the other end of the spectrum where you're getting more berry, cherry fruit flavors, but you're drinking something that's lighter, something that's lighter in color as well, and something that you can chill and drink easy on a patio.
Now, this wine is very popular in Europe. It has been. It's taken a while for rosé to take off in the States. It took a little bit longer for it, but the numbers that you're throwing out, they're staggering for a wine to be consumed at that level.
Oh, yeah. I mean, people in Europe have been drinking it for, I think one of the biggest things is I've been to Europe. I see guys drinking pink wine. They have no problem with their masculinity over there. And then you come back over here and people were like, oh, I'm more of a beer drinker myself. And, you know, but I think a lot of people have gotten over that stigma and they just don't care. They finally taste it and they said, this thing tastes good. It's so refreshing.
Where's it come from? So give me an idea of the grape, because I went into Binny's not too long ago because I was like, oh, I got to get a bottle, right? And I was so flummoxed by the aisle that was just as far as the eye could see, rosés from France, from Italy, from Austria, from Spain. There were so many different varietals, and I guess I'm ignorant. I was like, I thought it was just a French wine.
Right. So they make them everywhere. You can make rosé out of any grape that has a red skin. Basically, the white juice is pressed out in the skin contacts with that for just a few hours just to get a little bit of pink into it. And, I mean, you hit it on the head. Almost any country, almost any red grape varietal you're going to be able to get it to. And they're going to taste different, each one. I highly encourage everybody to try California, Argentina, Rosé of Malbec, rosés from just about any country in Europe. They're all going to be really tasty, but they're just going to be really different. And one of my favorite places to get it from, though, like you said, with France, I always tell everybody you can't go wrong getting something from Provence.
Okay. Now, I always see this, and again, I have no concept of wine. I need to get better at this, but I always see it as there's a Pinot Rosé. Right, and you just mentioned a Malbec rosé. What does that mean? That they're different varietals of rosé.
Basically, the grape varietal, it's just a type of grape. So it's a Malbec vine that grows Malbec grapes.
Okay.
It's a Pinot vine that grows Pinot grapes. So that's basically the difference between the two of them.
Okay,
well,
so
all of them.
All of them, right? I was in a restaurant in Chicago not too long ago, and they had Greek rosé. I'd never seen that. I was like, wow, and it did taste different. And like when I was done, I was like, that doesn't taste anything like the fruity stuff I get from the Jewel.
Yeah, depending on where it comes from, I mean, you can get a lot more minerality out of it. You can get a lot more floral qualities out of it. You might not get all of those fruit components that you're used to with maybe something from Argentina or something from the West Coast. It's going to be totally different, but...
It follow the same logic when it comes to price points? Do rosés, because I go into Whole Foods now, and Whole Foods has the whole, you know, the whole cooler is just rosé and anything from $12.99 to $25.99, whatever it is. But, I mean, is there a price point? Does it follow the same as white wine and red wine? There could be $3.99 rosé and $15.99. What's a good price for a rosé?
I think you could be able to find rosés anywhere in that $10 to $15 price range. I think with a lot of, even your whites with your reds, but it's going to be the same thing where you have different wine producing regions like, let's say, Taval or maybe something out of the Languedoc in France where they're going to be a little bit more prized rosés as opposed to something that you're going to be able to get larger quantities produced in California or even in South America. But those wines you can find in that $10 to $15 range, they're nice rosés.
312-981-7200 if you got a question about rosés or wine production. Let's take a quick break. When we come back, I'd love to talk about wine production here in Illinois or in the region, in the Midwest. You know, I didn't think about wine being a thing here when I was in California, as I mentioned. I learned so much just going through winery tours. The first time I ever did that. And just going through it, I automatically had curiosity to, well, what happens in the Midwest? I kept asking everybody. They said, I think Michigan's got good stuff. Like, but I want to know about what's being produced here and what it takes to produce great wine in the Midwest. Michael Botelliero is in studio. He's the Windy City Wine Guy. You can find him at windycitywineguy.com. He's a certified sommelier and wine consultant. We'll continue the conversation right after the break. Stay with us. That's appropriate for our conversation. Popping tops.
Yeah.
Perfect. It's like they planned it that way. In studio with me, Michael Botelliero. He is the Windy City Wine Guy. You can get him at windycitywineguy.com. You can also, he's a certified sommelier and wine consultant. We're talking about rosé, but let's transition. I was interested in, when I went on this wine tour, it was almost on a whim. And I realized that I've kind of been making fun of people for going on wine tours their whole life. I'm like, oh, Mr. Wine Tour, you know, and it's the first time I did it. And then it made me think about Chicago and the area. I mean, does Chicago produce wines of substance or this area, the Midwest region?
Yeah, so all the lower 48 states all make grapes for wine. In all 50 states, people make wine in those states as well. So in Illinois, lots of wineries. We actually have what's called an AVA, which is an American Viticultural Area, down in southern Illinois,
okay,
called the Shawnee Hills AVA. They make a lot of wine there.
Is it good?
They make some decent stuff. They have 20 different wineries, or maybe a little bit more than that. It's definitely worth a trip down there. I still haven't gone. I'm looking forward to it. But and then even in the Chicagoland area, so you asked about that, They make wine grapes around here as well. And then there's a few worthwhile places to visit also. You can go to one of my favorites to go to is Linfrid. They're out in Roselle.
Okay.
They bring in a lot of grapes from California to make some wines, but they also use local fruit.
So that really is, when you talk about a vineyard, that means that they're making the grapes right there. But there are a lot of wine producers who will ship grapes from other places and be located in this area.
Exactly. So that's just a winery, okay, then, where they're making wine out of grapes from just about anywhere.
Okay.
But we make some decent stuff here. The trouble with Illinois is that we have the really rough winters. It's really cold, so you need these hardy grape vines that can withstand a winter.
Right.
And it also can put up with some summers that may not be so hot, or like we experience here, where it's 100 degrees for maybe a month and then forget about it. It's just gone. So. Really?
Well, what about? I always hear Michigan, like along the lake, vineyards or wineries, and that part of the area is.
Yeah, Michigan is a really great place for picking up some wine or even to do some wine tours. Southwest Michigan, really close by. You know, you just go right over the Indiana border. You step in there, and then there's some really nice wineries. Round Barn is a really good one. You've got Lemon Creek. And then if you feel like taking the trip further north, it's about a 5-hour drive. But going to Traverse City is a real treat.
Right.
Some of the best wineries that you're going to go to in the United States, not on the West Coast, are up there. Black Star Farms is a fantastic place. They make everything from white wines out of Riesling, Pinot Gris. And then you can even step into some Pinot Noir if you're into the reds. Pinot Noir, Cabernet Franc.
Okay.
I might have to do that.
That must, sounds like a good thing to do. I mean, are you the kind of guy as a pro, as the Windy City Wine Guy, you're a spit guy? Are you going to take a sip? Because I'm not. I realized quickly, I'm like, what am I doing here? I don't even know what I'm doing. The woman's like, are you going to spit out? I'm like, no, don't touch my wine. I'm going to finish this.
So I've gone to local distributor tastings where they'll have probably about 80-plus wines there. So if you want to walk out of there, you have to do some spitting. What I usually do is I pick out the first wines that I really want to hit, so maybe about 8 of them, and then I'll spit with those. And then, you know, on the way out, then I'll have some a little bit of drinky-drinky and Uber home.
Yeah, there you go. Right.
Yeah,
see, yeah, of course.
Home.
No one's driving. Right. That's the first. We Ubered up to the hills to do that, and then we're like, oh, wow. I was surprised. This was right outside of Monterey. I was surprised there wasn't more of an infrastructure, because we got in the Uber, and I'm like, oh, this is great. We'll just Uber up to take 20 minutes to get up there. And the guy's like, I've never been up here before.
Wow.
And we're like, well, how do you get back? He's like, no one ever comes up here. Like, no Uber does. I think you can hit a trolley. And I'm like, what is this? this? This is terrible. I don't want this. I'm a city guy. I'm a Chicago guy. I don't have time for this. All right, let's talk about, you know, wine production, obviously. You know, there's so much that goes into wine culture. I mean, the words involved. I that was something that I had a hard time with. I was like, I don't understand what acidity is. I don't understand what, you know, body means. So let's talk about that. So when they say it's a full body, what is it? What is full? I mean, I get the idea that it's rich, right?
Right. Or,
yeah.
So yeah, a body is such a big term in wine, but it's just really basic. You take some of the wine in your mouth, and it's the difference between what water would feel like in your mouth versus what milk or cream would feel like in your mouth. It's just a weight factor. So your lighter style of white wines like Sauvignon Blanc, or even your lighter style of red wines, Pinot Noir, are going to feel a little bit more racy, a little bit more watery. And then when you move across the spectrum over to Cabernet Sauvignon or Chardonnay, you're going to feel much more of a weight in your mouth, almost like you had cream in
your mouth. So those are the Chardonnay and Sauvignon. Those are a little bit more creamy. Those are
right,
full
so that's
body.
Where you get really good body out of. Now, these are just generalizations with the grape varietals. I mean, I've tasted lighter-bodied Chardonnays. I've tasted maybe medium Cabernet Sauvignon or maybe even fuller Pinots. But just on a general speaking, that's where it's at.
Okay, and then is the word tannins? Is that the word?
Yeah, so grape tannins.
Tannins, okay.
You're getting this from mostly from the grape. What ends up happening is that you leave that white, clear juice that was popped out. You leave it sit with the grape skin. The grape skin starts to leach all of that grape skin material into the wine, depending on how long you leave it in there for. Sometimes, you know, 20 days plus. You get a lot of grape skin matter out of there. And it's all of those microscopic particles that are floating around. When you take it in your mouth, it kind of latches right onto your gums. And you feel that really big grip, like your gums are being dried out. That's how you can really feel like the tannic content of a red wine. Now, you also have oak tannins as well. So depending on how long a wine spent in an oak barrel, that's going to be in there too. And that's where you can actually taste it in a barrel fermented, barrel aged Chardonnay.
Well, I mean, we'll get, that's another, well, I'm going to have to have you back because barrel versus the other ways that wines are produced. I mean, now wines are on tap. Which is something I didn't know happened. Michael Botelliero is in studio with us. He is the Windy City Wine Guy. All right, so if I'm going to, this is what you do. If I'm going to, like, you're going to consult on a wine party. That's sort of what this business is.
That's my stick, right?
Yeah. So what is a wine party? What does that mean?
So you can do. It's different depending on if it's a private or a corporate one. But the basics is you're going to have wine there, a few different kinds.
It's like a tasting.
Yeah, so a tasting. So like, let's say a client of mine wants four different wines, and we taste through maybe a sparkling, a white, and two reds. Well, it's coursed out, so everybody will taste the sparkling wine. We'll talk a little bit about that wine, and then just keep moving along that way. Food pairings, always a fun thing to add, or cheese pairings too. One or two cheeses with each of them, some food. And then just keep moving along. That's a really fun time to have with your friends.
All right. Last question I have for you tonight. I've got a dinner party next weekend, and I want to find a bottle of wine that's on the way. So it's, you know, I don't want to get crazy. That's probably a grocery store variety. That's going to look expensive, but not be expensive for when I bring it. So I'm like, oh, look at this label. I mean, that's essentially how I pick wine, how fancy the label looks. That's
nice,
my
nice.
Style of picking wine. For you, I mean, a $10 to $15 variety, what's a good bottle of wine? What's a good recommendation?
In that price range, I find a lot of stuff that you can get from Australia. Shield Estate, for example. They make a Grenache Mourvèdre Shiraz blend that you can get for around $14. The label looks great.
Am I going too cheap? Am I too cheap at $10 to $15?
Oh, no. To tell you the truth, a majority of the wines I drink at my house in that $15 or less range.
Right.
Every once in a while, I'll drag something out, you know, a special
occasion. Like for graduation, you go up to 18.
Yeah. Hey, sometimes I'll say it's Friday, I'll drag something good out. But for the most part, like I said, $15 or less is a really good price
range. Right, that's the right price range. For me, I feel like I'm being sophisticated enough, and I'm also not breaking the bank.
90% of all wines consumed are $15 or less.
There we go. See? We're pulling the pretentiousness out of wine.
Exactly. Here. Let's
the
just
Windy
take
City
it out.
Wine Guy. WindyCityWineGuy.com. Michael Botelliero is in studio with us. Thanks for coming in. You got to come back. We got to do this again. Take some calls, do something, talk wine.
Oh, yeah.
I'm so happy
like
to talk
to hear
about
me,
it.
Riff about some more wine, right?
Michael, thanks for being here. How about that? I feel like I'm on the right. If anything, that segment, I feel like I'm on the right path. Do you feel like you're not much of a wine drinker?
No, but I do.
You have to get a wine, bottle of wine. Sometime.
Yeah, yeah. I'm fine with drinking a rosé every now and again.
Like, I just feel good that my instinct of going 15 and under, and almost like sticking to that.
Mm-hmm.
Whenever I'm at the store and it's like, well, 20 would be good. I'm like, that just seems egregious. It should be 15 and under. And I was always in my head being like, I must be the cheapest guy in the world. And then to hear Michael say that now 90% of wines are 15 and under, I'm like, yes, vindicated.
And how about like when you're at a restaurant?
Oh, that's the worst.
And that you don't want to buy, there's limited options perhaps for glasses. And then you don't want to buy the cheapest one because you don't want to look. So you look at like the Homer Simpson, the second cheapest.
I was at a restaurant not too long ago and I had that situation where, and I don't know why I leave this stuff to chance. But it was like one of those where there were two or three and I was just being cool. There was like four or five people. And I'm like, you know what? We'll take a bottle of Pinot, give me the good one or not give me the good. You choose. And in my head, I'm like, I want to see if I come back with like the most expensive one. If the waiter is like, well, I'm going to take
tell?
This. Yeah, take for a ride. And it was second most expensive. So I was like, I think there were four bottles. So I was like, me, if I were the waiter, I'd go for the second least expensive, right? That's a tough one.
Yeah, that is a tough one.
Rob?
I'm just worried about the two of you.
Just here sitting here talking about wine.
No, the wine conversation is great. I'm a 15 and under guy myself.
Yeah, right?
Yeah.
Good. See, I feel like that's the secret of our society right now. No one will admit they're 15 and under wine guys.
And I do it by the look of the label as well.
Exactly.
If it catches my eye, then I'll act like I know something and actually read the description on the back. Oaky, that's good. Yeah.
And I'm going to have Michael back because the one thing I noticed, because the reason I kept talking about California is my brother lives in Modesto, California, which is out about an hour and a half from San Francisco. Right, and that's where we went out there, and it's kind of wine country as you wind through there, so that's why there was a wine tour the whole bit. But in Modesto, the town is pretty much owned by Gallo Wines. Remember Gallo Wines?
Yeah.
Right. And what we know is Gallo Wines. I'm like, oh, yeah, Gallo, Ernesto Gallo.
Yeah.
Or, you see that? Right.
In the box, baby.
Right, the box or the jug. But what I didn't know is that most of the wines that are those flashy labels that Mr. Martyr grabs because he likes, they also are made by Gallo. Like, Gallo just makes a ton of the wines that are making it into the grocery stores. You know what I mean? Like, they're not, you think they're from everywhere, and there's so many different wine companies in the world. Like, oh, look at this vast array of diverse wine companies in this aisle. No, they're all made by four companies that are just made to look different.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It's like a lot of things in our culture. We don't think that's the way it is, but it is. And I didn't recognize that. I always thought, I'm like, oh, this one's made in California.
Yeah, right.
No.
Same.
Yeah, they're all the same company. It's like a Simpsons where it's all coming from the same vat. It's a different label. So anyway. All right, well, we're going to make a transition. We're going to talk a little theater coming up here after the news. It's a download here on WGN Radio. I'm Justin Kaufman with you till 11 o'clock here on WGN, of course. The Urban Theater Company is wrapping up its 10th anniversary season this summer with a production of Lolita de Lares. It's a play that explores a Puerto Rican rebel through the voices of 50 different characters. That rebel was Lolita Lebron. It's a fascinating story about a Puerto Rican national who, among others, went to the U.S. House of Representatives in 1954. And opened fire, and wounded four or five congressmen, congresswomen at the time, and went to jail, and was pardoned by Jimmy Carter in 1979. I said this at the beginning of the show, and I feel kind of embarrassed that I don't know that story, And it may be a generational thing. It's something that's not talked about, but it's a story that I feel like in this day and age, with this tenor, with the current climate and the way that stories of you know, this kind of thing would permeate our society. It hasn't. The play is written by Migdalia Cruz, a great playwright, originally produced for Latina Chicago Theater 21 years ago. Ivan Vega's in studio with me now. He's the executive director of the Urban Theater Company, which calls Humble Park home. He joins me now. Ivan, thanks for being here.
Oh, thank you for having me.
So, I mean, should I be embarrassed? I don't know the story. I mean, it's obviously, it's well documented. When I started searching, I'm like, oh, man, I can't believe I don't know this.
You know, unfortunately, it's something that it's the Puerto Rican history isn't taught in school, you know, and as a Puerto Rican growing up, I have had to learn a lot of things either through my family from traveling to the island, but really on my own. And I think the best education that I received getting more in touch with my culture, with my identity, is through running a theater company,
yeah,
because all of our plays have been predominantly by Puerto Rican playwrights.
Well, I mean, you guys are the preeminent theater company in the country that's doing Puerto Rican plays.
There's no one else. You know, all of our plays are in English, but they are by Puerto Rican playwrights, with the exception for possibly three. But even then, we still cast and we still bring to the table artists and designers of color.
How much do you know about this story, about Lolita Lebron? I mean, the play Lolita de Lares is written by Migdalia Cruz. But talk about this story, because it's a story that is, I mean, a big part of American history.
It is. With Latino Chicago Theater, they produced a play called Dolores. So her name is Lolita Dolores Lebron. And after that, they co-developed this Lolita de Lares with ensemble members and Migdalia Cruz. One of the ensemble members is in our show right now, actually on stage right now.
That's
performing
great.
Lolita de Lares. So she is, she was a leader of men. She was one of the only Puerto Rican women who led men, who just believed that it was a message from God to do what she did, to go to the House of Representatives and to shoot, not to kill anyone, but to shoot and to prove a point. And she, I mean, what happened was the bullets ended up like ricocheting and ended up wounding five people there, but her intentions weren't to kill anyone.
She
wanted to die before she killed anyone else and die for her country.
Well, that's what it was. I mean, it was a political story. I mean, this was a different time. This was the early 50s. It had to do with Puerto Rico and the relationship with the United States. Talk about that.
Yeah, it ties in perfectly right now more than ever with the current climate of Puerto Rico, the fiscal crisis that's going on. It's a play that resonates so much more now than it did then, and it's a fantastic history lesson for anyone who wants to learn more about Puerto Rican history or learn more about Lolita. So through this play, it's a memory play of Lolita Anciana, which is like the older Lolita, and Lolita Mujer, who's the younger one. So you see flashbacks of her life.
Hmm.
You see moments of the actual shooting. You see the people, her compañeros, who she went to the House of Representatives with. So you get to see through Lolita Anciana all of this story with magic of the gigantes, which are, you know, the folkloric.
And almost, it really does feel, and I think you mentioned, I mean, the ability to put plays on stage that tell the story, tell the history, especially when that history is omitted from textbooks or they're not showing up. They're not, that's glossed over in both countries. I mean, that's not something that is necessarily talked about. It is important to almost tell the history through art, through culture, through plays.
Oh, for sure. And, you know, especially in Humboldt Park. And, you know, I'm fortunate enough, I also work with the Puerto Rican Cultural Center that's down the street from Urban Theater Company. You know, we're in partnership with the Puerto Rican Culture Center. We have their support. For me, when I'm in that office, it is, I'm a student because I'm constantly learning. The executive director of the Puerto Rican Cultural Center has a brother who is the longest incarcerated Puerto Rican political prisoner, Oscar Lopez Rivera. So there is a constant fight in the office to free him because it's been 34 years already. And, you know, at this point, it's like, you know, enough's enough, right? What are we going to do? This guy's 70, almost 73 years old. Let's let him go. So the struggle is there, and it's live, and it's vibrant, and it's a sneak peek of what that struggle was with Lolita and the people around her, and the struggle that exists not only here but everywhere else. So there's a huge support all over the world to free Oscar Lopez. So, you know, it gives me chills because it ties into this. And Jose Lopez was telling a story about Lolita and how he used to talk to her. He would go to jail and have conversations with this woman.
Wow.
When we had the first reading, he sat down and just educated like the cast and everyone who was there. And just amazing to listen about this woman and how strong she was, you know? I mean, to the Puerto Rican community, she is this iconic figure of the independence, of the struggle, of the fight to free Puerto Rico.
Fascinating story. The play is Lolita de Lares. It's by Migdalia Cruz. It's on stage at the Urban Theater Company, which is at the Bate Urbano Theater, 2620 West Division Street. The press is tomorrow. It opens this weekend. My guest tonight, Ivan Vega. Let's take a quick break.
Sure.
Come back. We'll continue the conversation.
All right.
Stay with us. It's a download here on WGN Radio. I'm Justin Kaufman here in studio with Ivan Vega. He's the executive director of Urban Theater, which is putting up the show Lolita de Lares, which is by the playwright Migdalia Cruz, directed by Marcela Munoz. It starts June 20th. It's running on stage till July 24th at 2620 West Division, Bate Urbano, Urban Theater, Chicago.com. Ivan Vega, you know, we were talking about stories and being able to tell stories on stage. You know, you're in a neighborhood in Humboldt Park and on the west side of Chicago that's seen a lot of change and has had a fight, a gentrification fight. But there's been, you're the only theater company in Humboldt Park. Talk about how important it is to be attached to a community like Humboldt Park.
It's extremely important for us. When we started, our goal was to form a theater company that showcased our culture, our identity, our people. You know, the Puerto Rican story, and I'm an actor as well, so I wanted to be on stage and portray roles that I was not getting. And being a Puerto Rican theater company, we had to connect with Humboldt Park. We had to connect with the Puerto Rican community, and it hasn't been easy, right? Working in the community, the hardest thing is to do a show in the community, but to get your neighbors to actually come see your work
because
they don't know who you are. Like, who's this guy? What are they doing, right? What are they contributing to the community? So our
especially,
audience,
I mean, the last 10 years where they're like, we don't even know if you're a part of our community.
Exactly.
You know, they
see
me.
Starbucks, you know, a lot of people see me and they were like, oh, he's probably not Puerto Rican, or he's probably, you know, who's this guy? Does he live in the community? And I do, right? I live 3 blocks away from the community. The theater's 3 blocks away, and I work 1 block away from the theater. So everything I do is within 3 block radius. And fortunately, within the last couple of years, we have connected with a lot of people in the community. We have produced work where the community can actually connect with the content that we're providing, with the voices that the people that they've heard about but don't know much about, like, we did a play about Julia de Burgos, which is another huge figure considered the greatest Puerto Rican Latina poet of, you know, in the country, right, in the world. She's amazing. So we produced a play about her. The last play that we did was a play about Puerto Rico possibly being the 51st state.
Mm-hmm.
So all these plays tie into each other, and we continue to produce plays that a lot of people aren't touching on.
I'm fascinated by the idea that, you know, as a community theater, I mean, a theater that serves the Humboldt Park community, the Puerto Rican community here in Chicago, and also the preeminent Puerto Rican theater company in the country, because, you know, people aren't producing Puerto Rican plays as much. what's the relationship between getting the community to come to the stage and getting other communities from Chicago, other people, theater goers, to come and experience the diaspora that is Puerto Rican theater in Humboldt Park?
I think the easiest thing has been to get the other people outside of Humboldt Park to come see our work.
Interesting.
Right. It's
So you'll get more people from different communities.
I always ask every single person, if I'm not on stage, I'm asking people, how are you? Where are you from? About the show, right?
Right, right.
Where are you coming from? You know, I plug the community because I'm proud of the work that's being done in the community, and I'm proud that we're actually contributing to that. So there's a large... number of Latinos that come in that are not from the neighborhood. There's a large number of college students who come in. A lot of people that go to the Goodman, the Steppenwolf, and these bigger companies, or they see it online and they're like, wow, something about it just caught my eye and I want to see the work. So,
well, there's variety in it too. I mean, the idea of being the only company that is producing this kind of work, I mean, there is an. I'm interested. Yeah. You know, I'm intrigued as a theater goer to experience a Puerto Rican written and directed play.
And our goals are to, outside of being that theater company in Humboldt Park, is to connect with the businesses in the community. I want our people to spend money in Humboldt Park when they come to see our show, to contribute to these businesses that are struggling. You know, they're having a hard time on the Strip. You know, you go east of Western, and there's a complete shift of what used to be a Puerto Rican neighborhood, and it's lively, right? But it doesn't have that sense of community, of culture that we're trying and fighting and trying to preserve within Humboldt Park.
You talked about yourself as an actor and as a director, as an executive director. You have gone to the homeland, and you've done things to learn more about your community, about your history. Do you see, younger Puerto Ricans who are in Chicagoans, part of the Puerto Rican community here, searching for that identity, searching for that history, understanding a little bit more about the generations that came before and the struggles they had here in this country?
Oh, for sure. Certainly. There's I see it on a daily basis when people come to see our work. You know, they thank us for producing these plays, or I see the reactions when they're watching the show, and there's a sense of pride. There's a sense of pride for what you're seeing on stage, because you're able to put on stage the things that you've seen and you've read, but you actually can experience it through art, theater, and through a lot of the universities as well. So I'm able to connect with some of them and work with them and involve them within the company. They want to learn more about where they're from. I continue to learn more about myself, about my heritage, about my ancestors, you know? So it never ends.
Do you, I mean, this is a tricky question, but do you run the risk as a theater company of sort of adjusting your theatrical approach, purpose, when big issues like immigration or issues in the Latino community bubble up? Mm-hmm. Donald Trump, politics, something like that, where you're like, we should have a play about that, as opposed to staying strict to the idea of telling the history of like with Lolita or others, where it might not be the story that everybody's talking about.
There's those are ongoing conversations that we have with the ensemble, right? Who are we serving being in the community? It has to be the Puerto Rican community because we're there, but then there are stories that are relevant, such as immigration, that we've also talked about. We met a playwright from New York, and she wrote a play about Elvira Arellano, who took refuge in a Methodist church on Division because they wanted to deport her.
I remember
right?
that, yeah.
So she lives two blocks away from where the theater is at, and this playwright from New York wrote a play about her story, which is on the back burner that we want to visit because it's completely relevant as well.
Local,
it may
right?
not be Puerto right. Rican, but we also want to tap into that voice and tell meaningful and relevant stories.
Well, it's I mean, the story of Lolita Lebrón is chilling, and it's one that's not told that much in American history. Looking into it today, I was fascinated by it. Mm-hmm. Ivan Vega's in studio with me. He's the executive director of the Urban Theater Urban Theater Chicago. The show is Lolita De Laris. It's on stage until July 24th at Urban Theater Chicago, which is at 2620 West Division Street. Ivan, thanks for coming in, man. And thanks for talking about this, and good luck with the show.
Oh, thank you so much.
This is Chicago's very own 720 WGN Chicago and WGNRadio.com. Coming up, Swap Meet, 312-981-7200. You got something that you think is worth something? I just got real, like, either late night commercial or guy on corner real quick.
Both.
Yeah. Hey, you got something that you think is worth something? Hi, I'm Justin Kaufman of The Download on WGN.
Also, you've been involved in an accident?
I can get you money. So much money.
We don't collect unless you do.
It's The Download here on WGN Radio. I'm Justin Kaufman with you till 11 o'clock tonight. You know, we all own something that connects us to this great city. Whether it's memorabilia or a souvenir, we go out of our way to keep it from the trash bin. When we move, we take good care to preserve it. It's not junk. It's Chicago history, and it's worth something. What do you have? Tonight, it's time for Swap Meet. It's like Chicago Antique Roadshow. You call in and impress us with what you have, and we tell you if it's worth anything. 312-981-7200. It's a chance to trade, barter, brag, you know, about the things that we've collected over the years. My guest tonight in studio, Greg Flam. He goes by the name DuPage Picker on social media, at DuPage Picker on Twitter. Greg, good to see you.
Thanks, Justin. Thanks for having me.
It was such a great segment.
Oh, so much fun.
So much fun, and you bring stuff in. I mean, what you do, I mean, this is essentially, you know, this is your job.
Pretty
much. The idea that you go online and find the value and sell junk.
Sure, yep, and different estate sales, garage sales, swap meets, of course, and just try to find that item that can be repurposed or is just kind of rare and maybe just unique. And some stuff isn't worth hundreds of dollars or thousands. Sometimes it's just $10, but people are like, wow, I totally forgot that, you know, or, you know, just bring back a memory or something like that. So it's a lot of fun. And I don't know, it's my passion. So
well, now you got a radio segment out of it.
All right.
312-981-7200. Let's talk about what we got tonight. So last week, I'll never forget, you had the Wizzo Magic set.
Right.
Or last time we did this, you had a lot of Bears paraphernalia.
Right.
You had a Jane Byrne coloring book.
Right. Yep.
Let's talk about what you got this week.
All right. Well, brought in some ticket stubs to different concerts and sporting events.
Oh, okay.
I brought in a Chicago Fire seat cushion from back in the day. My favorite is this rock strap. AM radio, and it's solid state, and the thing's got to be, what, the size of, I don't know, a couple Oreo cookies on a wristband, but it came out in the early 80s, and it's only worth about $12.
It's a radio watch.
Yeah, but it's
watch
just,
radio.
And the graphic, this is something you would see in a TGI Fridays.
Right.
You know, I mean, this
right.
would be on the wall, you know, and I just, that's kind of what made me get it. Plus, some of these things are like, you know, I didn't have a lot of money growing up, and it's like you see the toys and things when you were growing up, and now you see them, you can afford them and buy them. So that was one of the things I remember when it came out. Wow, this is so cool. I really want
the rock strap.
Right, you know, and just that it's called rock strap. I mean, come on, can't think of a better name. But it was put out by Kmart, and so I thought that was kind of a little local
Where
story.
Where did you find it?
I found it at a estate sale, buried in the basement amongst a lot of garbage. But I found it, and it's roached. I mean, they left the battery in it, so it's roached. But it looks great. And the box, like I said, a lot of people just buy for the graphics, you know. Even albums, you know, they don't care if it's scratched up. They just want, like, especially like Dragster type car albums, the Jan and Dean stuff. They like that just to display it. They don't even care about the audio.
When you do concert tickets, where are you finding that stuff? Is that the same kind of thing? Like, where
these
are you finding
stuff? Pretty much my personal concerts that I've gone to, but I
so
have
this is
found
really just a
some.
Brag. This is a brag job.
Yeah, a little bit of that.
Grab, look
yeah,
at how cool I am.
Yeah, but, you know, the seats aren't the best, so don't zoom in too much on them. Yeah, but I do find other, and you know, a lot of the 70s supergroup, rock group stuff, you know, tends to sell. You know, Van Halen and Fleetwood Mac ticket, you know, stuff
really?
Still sell, yeah.
People, I mean, what do you mean selling? What do people, they want to buy?
Ticket stubs. Yeah, I mean.
Like a Van Halen ticket stub?
Yeah, Blackhawks ticket uh-huh. stubs are big. They do all different things. They'll decoupage like a door and make a table out of it and stuff like that. They'll just people repurpose and that's what they do.
Some sort of art skill.
Yeah, same thing like with Scrabble tiles. People don't. They just collect the tiles and they just cover a wall or a door or something and sell it. You know.
Interesting. All right, 312-981-7200. Let's go to some of the texts because and they're coming in now fast and furious. We got some people on the line too. 312-981-7200. 708 says, I have a plate from Marshall Field's Walnut Room, a Norman Rockwell image of a man setting the State Street clock.
Wow. Well, that's funny because tonight I brought in Marshall Field's Frango Mint Liqueur.
Okay. There you
still
go.
Still sealed. I've only seen it once.
Yeah, wow.
And, you know, the Frango stuff is obviously, you know, what a lot of people remember Marshall Field's from. But the porcelain clocks that held, like, the Frango Mints, those can get, like, $50 empty.
Really?
Yeah, I've sold one of those before. But, yeah, Marshall Field stuff
stuff is hot? Like, are not hot, but people like that?
I look up Marshall Field bags, and I've seen, like, a lot of the bags just go for, like, $45, just the empty bags, you know? The mistletoe is a big thing, too. The teddy bear mistletoe from Marshall Fields, that generally is, you know, is a big seller.
Let's go to Mary on the line. It's Swap Meet. Mary, what do you got, Mary?
It's a print, and I don't know if it's worth anything. I bought it many years ago. It says, official bird's eye view of the World's Columbian Exposition, Chicago, 1893.
Wow. Yeah, the World's Fair stuff, some of that is worth a lot, some not so much. That's obviously probably out of my realm a little bit. But it sounds cool. I would definitely maybe have it checked out somewhere.
I mean, what's a print go for? Thanks, Mary. What does a print go for? I mean, is that could be commemorative, that could be 50 years after the fact.
Right.
Could, you know, like it could be just a poster, right?
Right, yeah, it could be a poster, could be... like I said, the different World's Fairs tend to vary the price. You know, it's I don't know how to explain that, and it's like I said, it's not something I'm an expert in that part. But yeah, it's something I definitely would have appraised or have someone look at.
Greg Flam's in studio. You can get him at Twitter at DuPage Picker. We're talking swap meet. What do you got? What's some good Chicago specific stuff that you got at home and you want to see if it's worth anything? Greg will let you know if it is. 312-981-7200. We'll take a break. Stay with us. Any excuse to have clarinets on the show
right.
works out really
That's
well here.
The road show music.
It is. It's swap meet here on WGN. I'm Justin Coffin. In studio with me, Greg Flam. You can get him at Twitter at DuPage Picker. We're talking what do you got when it comes to your stuff, your junk, your iconic Chicago souvenir stuff. Let's get into that because that's the stuff as the calls are in and people want to know what they got. They want to know what it's worth, Greg. I mean, that's really – when you go to an estate sale, how long does it take for you to find something that's actually of value?
I could go to 5 to 10 sales and maybe find sometimes a banker's box full of stuff, sometimes just one or two items. It's weird because every weekend you have like a theme. Like one weekend I'll go to three sales that will have Atari stuff or, you know, we'll have like something that you don't see for months. And then all of a sudden on one weekend you see it, three sales. It's kind of weird.
All right, 312-981-7200. Let's go to Kathy. Kathy, you're on the air. Swap meet. What do you got, Kathy?
Hi there. I have two things. The first thing is a street, like it's a pink cardboard sign from when the Pope was here in the 78. It was, I remember we were leaving, I think it was Grant Park, and there was like those million people just walking the streets, and I was with my family, and I just pulled down one of the signs that was hanging up.
Wow, you're a vandal. You
know. Yeah.
No, that's pretty cool.
It's pink, and it's like cardboard or, you know,
Right.
Tape bulletin board.
And it's in pretty good shape. You didn't tear it while taking it down, or is it?
No, I folded it. I folded it.
Oh, okay. No, that's definitely cool. It's different from like the more common merchandise they would sell, the pins, the scarves, the T-shirts.
Yeah.
So that's kind of, you know, kind of cool. I think, you know, you should, if you were going to sell it, you probably could get a decent dollar for it. And it's definitely more rare than the usual.
What's the other thing you got, Kathy?
I have a Marshall Field hat box.
Wow,
it looks like it's, it might be like 50 to 60 years old because it was my mom's. And I would say from the late, probably early 60s, late 50s.
Right. I mean, Marshall Field stuff is still very collectible. Bags, even. I've seen a lot of like 40 bags go for like $50. The hat boxes still go for quite a bit. The porcelain clocks that used to hold the Franco mints, those you can probably get $40-$50 for those, you know, without the mints in it, you know.
That's pretty amazing.
Yep.
Well, thank you, Kathy.
Thanks.
Thanks for checking in. It's so fun. This is so fun. This is, I'm telling you, this is my favorite segment in the history of segments. Wally, what do you got, Wally?
I have a hockey stick that I got from a Ford dealership like in 68 and 69. It's not a game stick. It's a CCM Comet, you know, typical stick, but it's signed by, Bobby Hull's on there, Pat Stapleton, Billy Ray even signed it, Nestorinko, Warham, Pierre Palat.
That's amazing.
Yeah, that's awesome. I mean, you're obviously want to keep this, I would take it. You know, I mean, I
this is the art of the deal.
Right. Yeah, well, this is the part of the show. It sounds like, you know, you're really proud of it, and I don't know, I would probably want to keep that. Otherwise, I'd take it somewhere and have it appraised, you know, or take it to like a sports show where they do like baseball cards and stuff, and they'll appraise it for you there.
It was like every place I took to it, it says, well, it's not a game stick. Well, of course it's not a game stick.
So what? It's still signatures. Right? I mean, Bobby Hull alone.
Bobby Hull and Makita and Pierre Palat and Ken Warham and Eric Nestorinko.
Right. It shouldn't matter.
Billy Ray's even signed it.
Yeah, that shouldn't matter too much.
Wally, thanks. You know, I think that's awesome. If I were you, Wally, I would hold on to that one.
Right.
That was what I would do. Let's keep going. Love it. Jim, what do you got, Jim?
Hello?
Yeah, hello. What do you got?
Hey, Jim.
Yeah, hi there. I have a Fleetwood Mac ticket stub from 1977.
Wow.
Actually, it's July 24th, 1977, and it's seat AA1. It was first row center for the Rumors Tour at Chicago Stadium.
Wow.
And it cost me, you guys ready for this? It cost me a whopping $9.50.
Wow, that's awesome. My first concert was the Chicago Stadium, and it was Kiss, and my grandfather was so cool, he took myself and three other family members, and he braved himself through it. It was awesome. But no, we were just talking about ticket stubs, and I brought some myself. And Fleetwood Mac and like those 70s, 80s super groups, you know, Van Halen, Fleetwood Mac, anything like that. People buy those, and, you know, some are worth $5, some are worth $30. You know, obviously, it's best to probably put a lot together, like you know, 5 to 10 and throw them together.
Thanks. Oh, okay.
Thanks, Jim.
Well, thank you. Have a great day.
Thanks, Jim.
Man. You know, if I were Jim, I would. No one's going to buy those memories.
Right. That's the thing. You know, but
that's the key. Oh, I'm loving this. All right, let's try Pam. Pam, what do you got, Pam?
Hi. I have a signed photograph of Guy Lombardo, and he's very nice looking in this picture. And it seems funny to see him smoking a cigarette, and he autographed his hand on this photograph. So it's an original signature, at least.
Wow. That's so cool. He autographed the jacket, I take it, right? Or is it just a poster?
No. The actual autograph, the hand that's holding the cigarette has his name on it.
Okay. Wow. That.
I want it.
Yeah. I mean, you might want to hang on to that.
I really don't want it. It's my mother.
Oh, yeah. That's the thing.
I never even knew, you know, I didn't even know his music or anything. So.
Well, I mean, it sounds like something that'd be like in an Italian restaurant where, like, you and the owner, you know, with the signed picture. But I like that. I like that a lot.
Yep, they might want that.
Pam, thanks for that. Thanks, Pam.
Thanks.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye now.
Let's keep going. We got a couple minutes here before the news. Tony, what do you got, Tony?
Hello. I have a Mary Margaret McBride Encyclopedia of Cooking. It's still in the box. It's from 1960.
Wow.
Wow. I don't know what to say about that. It's kind of out of my realm a little bit as well, but if it's in the box and everything, is it hardcover? How is it binded?
It's actually in a hardcover box, but they come in like cardboard pages. I have not opened this up at all.
Cool.
Why haven't you opened it up? You just hold on to it?
This is from my father bought the building next door, and we were going through some items, and we found a whole bunch of things like this, and recipes from Betty Crocker from 1950, things like that.
Yeah, I would think that would be, worth something, especially cooking shows are so hot right now. People are decorating
put it up on eBay.
Kitchens and stuff. Yeah, so they might be into that.
Excellent.
Tony, thank you, man. I like that one. That one because that's like what we're talking about is the story behind the story about buying a building and finding that stuff or recipes from 60s cookbooks and stuff. That's really interesting.
Right. I had actual recipes on vinyl back in the day. They would put out in the 50s or 60s, like Betty Crocker would put out, whatever, five different recipes on a bunch of vinyl. I had, I think, the set of four. It was rare enough just to find one, and I happened to find all four packaged together, and you get it by mail back in the day.
Let's go to Tim. Tim, what do you got, Tim?
Hey, guys, two things. First of all, from the 1904 World's Fair in St. Louis, it's a toy metal car with no moving parts that's about 2 inches long with it's pretty much all a solid piece of metal, but it's very detailed in the metal stamping. That's one thing.
So it's like a lithograph tin type, or what?
No, that's just a toy.
No,
the other thing that I have is a lithograph picture of Riverview at night. That's almost like a Leroy Neiman-esque type of litho, but it's a jigsaw puzzle.
Oh, okay.
So those two items.
Ooh,
wow,
I like that too.
Yeah, that's definitely unique.
I think that, I like that a lot. The litho of Riverview is definitely something that, I don't know, how much do you come across Riverview stuff? I would think that that's a big
Quite a bit. The most popular thing I come across are the, ticket stubs in a frame, matted ticket stubs on each side, and in the middle, a picture of, Riverview, whatever. Yeah. And that's pretty common. But other than that,
a picture of you getting somebody getting dropped with very little seatbelt or anything
right
down there. Yeah.
Right, yeah.
That's what I love about whenever I see the documentaries that I think it was that Rick Kogan documentary about Riverview. It's on 11.
Right.
I'm like, I didn't believe in safety on these.
Speaking of amusement parks, though, Great America stuff from back in the day is collectible.
Oh, really?
I'll give one of my secrets is the souvenir maps of the park. People are displaying those on their walls. They're framing them and. I mean, I've seen maps go for about $100. These souvenir maps, yeah. I personally have sold one for 56 of the
What can I get for a Twicket?
Those
haven't made it yet into the...
I haven't seen that. But I do have quite a bit of other Great America stuff, like tambourine, stuff like that.
Greg Flam is the is DuPage Picker. You can get him on social media at DuPage Picker. This is what he does. He sells and buys Chicago stuff. And we're talking about it here on Swap Meet, 312-981-7200. Get in line now. We're going to take a quick break for the news. We'll come back and we'll continue Swap Meet. Stay with us. It's a download here on WGN Radio. I'm Justin Kaufman. We're in Swap Meet. Territory. I'm loving this. 312-981-7200. Greg Flam's in studio with us. We're going to be doing this every Thursday night here on the download. 312-981-7200.
Awesome.
It is awesome, man.
Yep.
There's something great about the community that's surrounding stuff.
Right.
Let's get right back to it. Charlie. Charlie, what do you got, Charlie?
Hey, Justin. How you doing?
I'm good. How about you?
Good. Good. I have a signed picture of Bobby Hull.
Mm-hmm.
Nice. I have a signed football from Mike Ditka.
Wow.
Okay.
And I have an original Comiskey Park seat.
Oh, wow. Wow. Can I ask you, do you get those, like the ball and the Bobby Hull signature, do you get that from just running into those guys and be like, hey, can you sign this, or is it more organized?
It's more organized.
So you go to a thing where there's a signing, or how do you get a football?
Yeah, exactly.
Right. I was going to ask you, did you get
it? Actually, it was given to me as a present.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I was going to ask, did you get like the Mike Ditka ball when he played for the Bears, or did you get it recently? It doesn't really matter, I guess.
Was he on the ball? Did he say, also get your prostate checked?
Right.
No, but he did call me later.
He did.
Oh, wow.
Thanks, Charlie.
Thanks.
That's good stuff. I mean, but that's going to be your run-of-the-mill. I mean, it's almost like a rite of passage for Chicago to have Mike Ditka autograph.
Right, and even the Comiskey Park seats are kind of, you know, they're cool, but they're kind of out there. You know, you can get them if you need
them. My roommate gave me at one time, and I'm not sure it was real. I mean, it could be a copy, but it was a signed Mike Ditka picture of him when he was flipping off.
Yeah.
You know, you've seen that when he's walking.
It's funny.
Yeah, that's
yeah, I think I have the full-blown poster of that, and that's really rare. I've seen a lot of the 8x10s of that, but that is iconic. That's almost like the Johnny Cash thing flipping off.
And I had a T-shirt that's I got at a Goodwill that was Mike Ditka, and it said something at the bottom like, we will not forget, almost like he had died, but it was like to 1992. It was like it was printed when he got fired.
Wow.
It was really dumb. And then, of course, I pitted it out. Like, I wore it like a hipster jerk. I should have kept it, but I wore it and
right,
filled it. So, all right. Let's go to Patty. Patty, what do you got, Patty?
What do you think it's worth? I got the actual wording of Marshall Fields, the metal Marshall Fields name that was on one of the walls at Northbrook Court
How did you get that? Did you go with a screwdriver and get that in the middle of the night?
I was thinking about that when I was on the phone right now.
That's awesome.
Yeah. No, I think I asked them if I could have one of them, and they kept one for me.
Oh, that's cool.
Nice. Great. That's awesome.
Yeah. That's.
What do you think of that? Thanks,
Patty. That is rare. That's the type of stuff, you know, that. It's not everyday stuff. You're not going to find that at a state sale, probably, you know, so definitely worth something. You might want to have it checked out. If you want to sell it, you'll definitely get something for it.
But that's also something that's pretty cool.
Yeah. And maybe she worked at the Northbrook Mall, and you know, she might want to keep it for that.
All right, let's go to Ann. Ann, what do you got, Ann?
I've got two brand new baseballs signed by Mickey Morandini. One was given at a benefit for ALS for Les Turner Association.
Okay.
And he's signed it Mickey Morandini number 1, and the other one is Mickey Morandini number 12. Okay. That one does not have one has the ALS on it, one is just a plain ball because he was at a benefit.
Right.
And promoted that, and then he threw a party for people who contributed one other time, and that one he signed also.
All right, thanks, Ann. Thanks. What's the going rate, Greg, for Mickey Morandini?
You stumped me on that
merch.
One. I have.
He's listening.
I have no idea. My brain is trying to flip through all the autographs.
Give me $25.
Right. Yeah. I would think it's probably worth close to that. But
is that what the, I mean? And nothing against Mickey Morandini.
Right.
A good Northwest Indiana product, but is that any baseball player that signs anything is worth something? I guess.
I don't know. I guess if you sell it or keep it listed long enough, you'll find somebody, that is interested in it.
So crazy for Mickey Morandini.
Right.
All right, let's go to Mary. Mary. Mary, what do you got?
Hi, I've got something really special.
All right.
Especially for your WGN listeners.
Okay.
Well, Wally Phillips used to give away Seymour Payson and Devon scarves.
All right, nice.
Great.
And I still have two of them. Two separate packages that I only slit the package open, never took them out, just looked at them.
So you're talking near mint condition on those, right?
They are in mint condition,
nice.
Not even near mint condition.
Okay. Well, if you opened it, it has to be near mint now.
Okay. No, I opened the package.
Yeah, that's just...
You wore it a couple times.
Giving you a hard time.
Yeah.
No, that's neat. Last time I was here, I had a bunch of WGN stuff. I had the fan that they would give out, like, I think Chicago Fest and keychains and things like that. And I collect radio stuff. So my favorites to find when I see, like, a WMET pin from back in the day, I can't resist. I have to have it. So.
Well, I like that. Mary, you know, I like the idea that she kept for all these years a scarf from
Wally
Phillips. That's kind of cool. Just being here at WGN Radio, that's radio history.
Right.
That used to be... stuff that he would hand out. Let's keep going. Virginia. Yep. Virginia, what do you got, Virginia?
You know, I have a graphic designer's depiction of the Bears when they won the Super Bowl in 1986.
Right.
Was sponsored by Marshall Fields, and the designer that was David Siskel. He did a lot of graphic designing.
Okay.
And it's the Chicago Bears, and he looks like a big grizzly bear, and he's got Chicago, the city of Chicago, underneath, and he's got the water tower in his hand.
Oh, wow.
And it's the 1986 champion.
And how big would you say that is? What size?
It's not quite 11 by 14. It's okay. Like 11 by 12.
Yeah, I mean, anything Bear Super Bowl, it's gone. It goes. Yeah,
it does
anything.
Go?
Yeah, Bear Super Bowl stuff.
I would think people are over it.
Oh my God, no? I can sell Super Bowl posters all day. You know, I don't know if you remember the Jewel Osco ones that they would put out back in the '80s, from 86 to like 90. No, I know. Yeah, I know that's not what you have, but anything Bear Super Bowl is basically what I'm saying will sell. Yeah. And it's worth stuff.
I had like some strange collection. I don't know where my dad got it, but it was like watercolored 4 or 5 action shots. Like, so they were like, maybe they were like a more horizontal kind of, you know, painting style.
Right.
But they were watercolors essentially of like Peyton running over Ronnie Lott.
Wow.
Or, you know, or you know, Dicka being carried off. And there was like 4 of them. Oh, we destroyed them. Oh,
and there's a big difference. If you take the Super Bowl poster versus just like a 89 or 88 poster, the Super Bowl all day, you can sell that every week.
All right, let's keep going. Let's stay on the topic of the Bears. Rick, what do you got, Rick?
I got the Marshall Field Christmas Bears.
Okay, the mistletoe ones?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Sometimes those are hit or miss. I've got a couple, and they've been sitting for a while, and sometimes I've seen them go for like $100, sometimes $50, and I don't know. I can't get rid of mine, though. I don't remember what I have it listed for, but... But if they're in great condition, yeah, somehow, somewhere, people are buying those.
All right.
I got them in the plastic.
In the plastic still, yeah. Yeah. Awesome.
There you go. Thanks, Rick. All right, 312-981-7200. We'll get to Jim. We'll get to Martin. I got a ton of texts to get to. We'll do a rapid fire. Let's take a quick break. We'll come back with Greg at DuPage Picker. It's Swap Meet. Stay with us. Playing Swap Meet tonight. We've got just about 7 minutes left, so... Now it takes on a different meaning, Greg, because now it's
right.
Now we really need to value our junk,
right?
As the pound kind of goes to junk status.
Yeah.
All right, let's keep going here, Jim. Jim, what do you got, Jim?
That's me.
Yep.
Yeah, I've got a set of about 40 cards here. Back in '85, when the Bears were in the Super Bowl or they having their year, you would get a card. A picture of a player, and on the bottom, it was a coupon. You know.
Okay. Were those the McDonald's ones?
Yeah.
Yeah, McDonald's put those out. Yeah.
If they won the Super Bowl, you got a Big Mac. If they lost, you got a cheeseburger.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. I remember those. I pick those up when I see them. They're better sold in a lot, or if you have the complete set, it's really hard to get, I guess.
Okay.
But yeah, anything again, Bears Super Bowl tends to sell pretty quick.
Let's go to Matt. Matt, what do you got, Matt?
How you doing? I got like a life-size Walter Payton cutout. It was like a Dominic's ad.
Wow.
And he signed that.
He did.
All right.
Yeah, and then I also have like a Walter Payton like football that he signed that. But on those things, he signed it like to Matt.
Okay.
And I was just wondering what the value of like Matt
when it when it puts the person's name, it kind of is a little bit harder to sell and usually sells for a little less.
Do the athletes know that?
But I mean, even if it's like a rare thing,
Well, the cutout definitely. Cutout. Did he sign that to Matt as well, or just his name on the cutout?
He did.
Yeah.
He did.
Yeah. I mean, I don't. Anything Peyton is usually holds its value, especially. But if it says to Matt, that kind of makes it a harder sell. It probably will sell, but you might not get as much, and it might take a little bit longer.
Okay. Martin, what do you got, Martin?
Hey, good evening, guys. A couple things, actually. I have a cover, actually the whole magazine, Rolling Stone, from like the early 90s when Tom Cruise was in, I think it was Days of Thunder or one of those action movies. And I went to Oprah Winfrey, actually, and he was there, brought the magazine with, and had a pen in the break, and I said, "Oh, hey, bud, you want to sign this picture?"
Wow.
So, wait, this is where it gets good. So he went to sign it, and there was no ink in the pen.
Oh, my God.
And I was like, Oprah, help me out. Oprah Winfrey found a felt tip marker, so he signed over the name again. So I actually have two signatures on this Rolling Stone magazine.
Well, first off, you're lucky to get that much time, you know, because sometimes you don't get that, you know, second opportunity to sign over.
Right. Well, I think she kind of liked me, so for whatever reason.
Well, that's cool. I mean, did he just sign Tom Cruise, or did he also put a name on it?
No, he just signed Tom Cruise.
Yeah, then you're golden there, you know.
What is a Tom Cruise autograph? Go for it. Thanks,
especially
Martin.
Rolling Stone. I don't know. That's something you have to look up. But again, without the name on it, it should be a little bit easier to sell.
Let's keep going here because we're running out of time. Jim, what do you got, Jim?
Me?
Yep.
Yeah, I got a ticket stuff from the last Stevie Ray Vaughan concert up in Alpine Valley.
Yeah.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, that's
you know that story, right?
Where
helicopter, right?
Yeah, some people chose not to go on the helicopter ride, and he did, and that's sad in his history, and that's an important part of any like guitar legend history. So that should easily, you know, be a collectible that someone might want.
Yeah, there you go. All right, let's get to some of these texts as we wrap it up here. 847, a 1969 Cubs World Series ticket.
Right.
Is that real?
We're thinking that was maybe pre-sale ticket, and then they didn't make the playoffs. But back in 69, I don't know how far in advance
someone
they were printing. I know nowadays
So the idea meaning that there was a World Series ticket that was printed, they got it, but then they crashed and didn't get past the Mets. Yeah.
Yep.
I got a ticket stub from Cubs playoff game where Bartman ball occurred.
Yeah, I have no idea what that'd be worth.
One of those too.
Yeah,
I would say about 39,000 people have that ticket.
Right. Yeah, I don't know if that'd be worth much.
847, a World's Fair matchstick box.
World's Fair stuff, like we mentioned, you know, could get some things. Matchbook box, I don't know, maybe $10, $12.
A 1993 ALCS Blue Jays White Sox Game 6 ticket stub. Toronto clinched in that game. That's an ALCS. That's not even a World Series.
Right.
In Chicago, that's a sucky memory.
It is. I remember that.
Is that when Bo Jackson came? I remember that they went, like, he came in a pinch hit or something in that game, and it was towards the end, and he struck out because he's a bum.
Yep. Well, I wouldn't say that. Bo Jackson lives in the area.
That's true. Sorry.
No, I mean.
Sorry, Bo. Bo knows. We love you. 630, I had a rock strap, a yellow one.
I
have McDonald's plates from the 70s, Lego space sets from the late 70s, $6 million man action figures, and Shogun Warrior 2-foot-tall action figure.
Yeah, those are the last three, the Legos, the Shogun, all that. Anything Bandai brand that did, like, the Transformers and stuff, that's hot. Even, like, I would find little pieces of, like, the feet of that stuff, like Transformers, and get, like, $56 for just a foot of it, of the stuff that was made in the 80s.
Poor Transformer had to be tortured to get that foot.
Right. I mean, it's like I found that in the middle of, like, nothing, and I just thought it might be worth something. So
708 says Subway Chicago Bulls horn hats from the 90s. I don't know what that is.
Yeah, I think I've seen those that are plastic with the horns. Yeah, I don't think they're worth much. Maybe $5, $10.
224 says I see people steal L train maps off the train all the time to try and get all the colors.
Wow. Yeah, I haven't heard of that one. Maps though do sell, especially older vintage ones. We were talking about Great America maps.
Yeah, right.
So,
how about 262? I ran into Steve Bartman in a bar. He signed a ball for me. No, you don't get anything for that.
Right, you get nothing.
Are you Steve Bartman? Oh, you found me.
And this is coming from White Sox fan.
Yeah, anyway. 847 says, I have a poster that had the wrong title, Revenge of the Jedi, for the first sequel.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, there was a controversy or an episode about the jackets that they put out. I guess they called the movie a different name. So that stuff is really big money.
Oh, that's a good one.
Yeah.
And then the last one tonight, 815 says, a Michael Jordan White Sox rookie card.
Wow. Yeah, baseball cards, it's not my forte, but...
I don't know how... I mean, I think at this day and age, you know, maybe. I mean, maybe you're getting some money off of it, maybe.
Yeah, Jordan
but I
stuff
just feel
still
like,
is okay.
Yeah, I mean, that's a big one.
Yeah, it is baseball, though. I don't know. So, got to check
Greg
that out.
Greg Flamm, you can get him on Twitter, at DuPagePicker. He is going to be on the program every Thursday through the month of July. He also, this Saturday, this is kind of interesting. You just throw this out here. This Saturday, 8 to 1 p.m., the Eisenhower Junior High parking lot, there's a junk in the trunk sale. That's 1410 75th Street in Darien. It's free admission. It's parking. Benefits a school choir trip. And you'll be there selling records?
Yep, just look for the guy selling records, and that will be me. And everyone.
And you could tell people, you give them advice. They get there and say, okay, here's what you should look for.
Sure, and if they want to swap something that they heard on this show or the past show, I'll try to bring it with and see if we can work something out.
Greg Flamm, we'll see you next Thursday. Great job
tonight.
Thanks
so much, Justin. It was fun.
That'll do it tonight. The download. We'll be back tomorrow night. This is Chicago's very own 720 WGN Chicago and WGNRadio.com. Coming up pretty late with Patty Vasquez here on 720 WGN.